Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of the Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Yeah. All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up. See this? This is my boomstick. It's a 12-gauge double-barreled Remington. S-Mart's top of the line. You can find this in the sporting goods department. That's right, this sweet baby was made in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Retails for about $109.95. It's got a walnut stock, cobalt blue steel, and a hair trigger. That's right. Shop smart. Shop S-Mart. You got that? Now I swear, the next one of you primates even touches me. Let's talk about how I get back home.
Why, hello, it is 25 minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of January in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Sometimes when I do that, I sound like an auctioneer to myself. Then other times, no. In any event, it is Monday. Thank you for coming by, making it part of your listening day. We are live from the, I already said the thing about the studios. Have I said the thing about the milk and the packing in the district?
I don't know. I don't actually listen to you at the beginning of the show. Excellent. I just heard a whole lot of blah, 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 and wait for my turn.
As long as we're on the same page there, then. All right. Well, just do the rest in your head. But hey, from high above the milk packing district here in the heart of glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon, it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's Monday, and welcome to Day 12. If you'd like to join us, it's 503-505-6964. By the way, don't think I missed that thing you were doing earlier where you had some piece of crud on your clothing and it was resisting all attempts to come off. You were doing that last hour and it was like you were just going at it like a woodchuck chucking wood.
Well, it's actually...
You had like a stain or something.
No, it's actually some kind of like a little... There it is. It's like a little splinter or something. And so it was actually stuck in my sweater. And I thought it was something I could wipe off. And I tried to flick it off. Then I tried to wipe it off. Then I tried to poke at it with my pen. And it turned out that it was... No, it was something that was just sort of stuck within the weave of my sweater.
I like a step number two for you with anything is to jab at it with a ballpoint pen.
Yeah, that's
things stuck in your sweater, growth on your hand.
Yeah.
Something in your ear, which I've seen you do as well, by the way.
Yeah.
I've seen you just... Here's the thing you do. You take a pen, you stick it in your ear, and then you swirl it around a little bit.
Well, yeah, because sometimes the headphones make the insides of my ears itch.
Okay. And so your solution is to, so you're not trying to get anything out of your ear except the itching sensation.
Yeah, it's just, and it's just the outer part of my inner ear. I'm not jamming it all the way down into my, like, eardrum or anything.
I don't care. It's not, look, it's not me that's going to perforate the inside of my head.
And I don't have waxy ears, so it's not like the pen is coming out all grungy or anything. I'm just, you know.
You weren't on the show when I had the, when I went in and I had my ear de-waxed at the clinic. At the hospital. Oh man, that was it. That was a show. You don't even know because I woke up one morning and the left side of my the right side of my ear was fine, or the right side of my ear. My right ear was fine, but my left ear, everything kind of sounded like this. And the thing is, like, sometimes it, you know, like if you sleep on it, or like if you just go into the shower or something, like it's clogged for a while, but then later in the day, because it was, and then it's fine. Like one day, 2 day, 3 day, 4, couldn't hear anything out of my left ear. Everything was just like I was hearing through a sock. And I finally was like, well, F this. I've got insurance. I'm going to go to the hospital. And I went in, and it was, long story short, because I told the story when it first happened, and I lament more than anything. I have few regrets in my life as deep as this one, that I did not take a photo of all of this as it unfolded. But the guy came in, and he looked into my ear with that little, you know, the light pokey. The thing that jab into your ear that's then got a light on the end of it that they typically just use for your eyes. But I guess they can use that to look into any crevice or narrow area of your body. Guy sticks into my ear, turns on the light, and then he just said something like, yeah, it's all full of crud, or something very much like that. I forget what it was.
He said, oh, my God. And that's all you heard.
And so they were doing the thing of, like, filling my ear full of liquid, like a warm sort of swishy, like a saline liquid, which you'd think would be bad for your ear to be blasting it full of water, but apparently not. Or maybe they just counted on the fact that I wouldn't know. And so they took, like, it was like a thing that you squirt mustard with at Nathan's Famous, but filled with warm saline, and they would jab it in my ear and go...
It's called an ear syringe.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
And they would fill my ear full of water, but here's the really troubling, if unsurprising thing in retrospect. They would squirt it all in, and then it would just stay, and it wouldn't come back out.
Oh!
And they'd use, like, two of those things. They're like... spraying my head full of, like, saline water, and then it just... And they're like, okay, now it'll come back out. And it was just like it would just stay. I don't know where it went. It was just in my head somewhere. So
this is explaining a lot, by the way.
It's just it was just one of those things. It was just going in, and you know, and you know, sort of a rats go in, but you know, they don't come out or whatever that is that does the roaches.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I heard through my ear canal. I heard the fateful words. This is so great, and of course, it made it better and worse that it was a hot nurse saying it. She said, "All right. We're going to have to get the stool softener."
Oh, for your head?
For my head. Because I guess the theory is that, well, not a theory, I guess the fact is that will work with any sort of impacted substance can be removed with stool softener.
Huh.
I guess it's anything. It's like, I guess if you had just a bunch of crap in your nose that they couldn't get out, that had been there forever and it had sort of like petrified.
It's like Drano for bodily waste.
Exactly. And so she said, "Now, I know what you're thinking." She said, "This is going in the wrong hole. Ha, 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 ha. But don't worry about it. This is a common use for a stool softener." And I was, you know...
It's not that common. I've never heard of it.
No, and that's what I said. Like, don't try to make me feel better that you're putting, like, ass lotion or whatever, like, in my ear. There's no making me feel better for that. That's just, like, the ship has sailed. I am filled with shame and apparently stool in my ears. So, you know... And so then it's like the jokes just write themselves, you know? Anyway, so they... kind of just squirted all the stuff in. Then she did that thing of, like, the thing that I guess, you know, has a reason, but it's sort of unnerving anyway, when she jams my head full of the stuff, like, and then she says, "Okay, I'm just going to let that sit for a bit. We'll be back in a while. Hey, you know, would you like a magazine?" And I'm, "No." You know, and they just let me sit there with stool softener in my head for, like, 12 minutes. And then she came back and... you know, and she did the, "Okay, now hold on a second. Now we're going to try something a little interesting here." And later I found out that what they were doing is she basically just had, this is why you reminded me of this, she basically just had like a, it was a medical implement called your sharp stick. And it was basically just like a stick you put a corn dog on, but sort of pointy at one end. It's kind of freaky. It was like I was being treated by the Viet Cong, and they were treating me for hearing. And they apparently put it in there, and they were just trying to, like, I don't know. It was sort of like I think it was like spear fishing, but except for, like, you know, for crud. And anyway, and so then at one point there was this whole, "Okay, now anyway, what we're going to do is, like, all right, now how's that? And I was, oh, my God, I can hear. And then they had, well, this is so gross, but at one point, as they were doing this, somebody had sidled up next to me, and they, this, like, you know, like an intern or an orderly or whatever, an assistant, had gotten underneath me with, like, a little, like, a, you know, like one of those, like...
A basin.
Like a little basin thing.
Yeah.
Because apparently, like, the 9 gallons of water they pumped into my head, they knew that that was going to come just, like, rushing out, like the Grand Coulee Dam, and it sort of just came pouring out. And then just like this, I kind of wish I'd saved it, not unlike you saved the top of your femur, and like you wanted to save part of Patrick's gallbladder. Because not a big surprise, my ear had been blocked by just an accumulation of wax because I had never gotten my ears, you know, professionally clean, because they said that some people don't ever need it. So some people, your ears just maintain themselves. Some people, the shape is just, it's just wrong enough that it's like you got to get it done every like 5 or 10 years because you get a little detritus that builds up in there. So basically, it was like someone had made a cast of the inside of my ear with like, you know, wax. And
wow.
It was sort of fascinating. A, it was huge, but also because it was shaped exactly, and you're like, that's what the inside of my ear looks like. It was this huge thing. It was sort of awesome, actually, in a sort of horrifying kind of way.
And yeah, and that stuff is disgusting, but fascinating. Like when I had a sinus infection, and I was treating the sinus infection and spraying stuff in and using the neti pot and doing all that. And then finally, after a couple of days of this, and my whole face just felt hot and impacted and miserable. Like Sarah did that one time when
right.
we were making Sarah use the neti pot. It was horrible. And then finally, when I was sitting on the couch one evening, and I just was blowing my nose and having the feeling like, please just stop being like this, please. And it was kind of like the thing with the ear. I blew my nose, and there was this noise, except it reverberated through my whole head.
Bum, bum,
and I
bum,
looked down bum. At what I had just blown out of my nose, and I swear to God, it was like an oyster. It was this round, fully formed, you know, thing. And I poked out with my finger, and it was just like, it was solid on the outside. And it was huge. And I just was like, oh, my God. And Patrick went, what? And I said, you have to look at this. He goes, no, I'm not going to look at the thing you just blew out of your nose.
No, I don't.
But the thing is, it's like, no, you don't understand. There's no way this should have been inside my head.
Exactly. Exactly. That's you're like, how could this have just been in me the whole time? And how did it not cause me trouble before? And it was, so you realize, that's one of those things where it just reaches a critical mass at some point. You know? Where it's like 97, 98, 90, it's like downloading a piece of software. 99, complete, and then you can't hear anything. Or you can't breathe, or, you know, whatever. So, and then it is sort of fascinating to go like, because that's the closest you're ever going to get to seeing the inside of your nose canal or whatever the hell. So, anyway.
We're disgusting.
Well, I was just reminded of that because you were jabbing the thing into your ear.
Yeah.
So, you know, so whatever. So if at some point you suddenly it's all muffly, you have that to look forward to. It was almost, I say almost now, almost worth the discomfort of not being able to hear for 2 or 3 days just to have, A, the interesting experience, and then also to have, like, the relief of when it was passed, you know? Where you kind of go, like, oh, thank God, I could finally... It was almost worth it at that juncture. Not entirely. All right. That was me rubbing my hands together like Mr. Miyagi. All right, it's 503-505-6964. If you'd like to weigh in today with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, musings of an ironic nature, whatever you have today. Or you can also text us if you like. That is, you text us via Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. That's your Skype username, Rick Emerson Show. You can also email. It's rick@rickemerson.com or Dawn, D-A-W-N, @rickemerson.com. Text box on the website, all that stuff. Let's see, coming up today. Penis Watch, Snuff Watch, Democracy in the March. Brief correction, we will not be speaking with Mr. Aaron Duran today. We're talking to him tomorrow. So tomorrow, Tuesday, the Week in Geek. So today, Penis Watch, Snuff Watch, Democracy in the March. Today's pop culture authority, we answer the question, what is up with that creature in the trash compactor of the Death Star? We'll also have today's top five most unintelligible hit songs. The top five most non-comprehensible hit songs. One of them may surprise you. It's coming up today with Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian. He's going to join us as well. So Penis Watch, Snuff Watch, Democracy in the March, Pop Culture Authority, and the top five. I am especially excited about today's top pop culture authority because I don't even know what the hell that thing in the Death Star trash compactor is.
I have, and this is detailed and educational and fascinating.
Now, were you just as fat? Like, was it a thing where you also, it was a revelation to you?
It was. I did not know the answer to this when we started talking about this, and now I do.
Excellent.
And it's fascinating.
So we'll get to all of that. That is coming up here in just a skosh, as our Asian friends say. This is all true. Don't forget, today's program is brought to you by EH Vending. EH Vending, among other folks. They help to bring you today's installment of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. This, by the way, this is a good time to note, the last week's winner. So last week's Name That Snack, the snack that we were describing last week that one lucky winner did in fact identify, that was Eric Vandervoort. And I asked Cheryl how often she thought that he got called Voldemort. And then she just told me that I was a tool and didn't really answer. So I don't know. But Eric Vandervoort correctly identified last week's snack as being pirate booty. That is pirate booty.
Pirate booty.
Which comes in five delightful flavors. So that is pirate booty. That is last week's snack. Today, though, we will give clue number one for this week's Name That Snack. And I got to tell you, this week's snack, you want to know what it is?
Sure.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to write it down.
Oh, no one will ever get that.
Isn't that amazing?
I never
would have thought of that myself. That's a thing that it would never have occurred to me. So so Cheryl has created this week's clues for Name That Snack. Don't forget, we'll give the clue out later on today. You got to wait until Friday to give your guess, or it'll be callously disregarded. Put in the round file, as they used to say.
In fact, Cheryl may just write back to you with taunting and laughter.
That is one of the things at which she excels. It's scorn and derision, pouring it upon you like salt upon a garden slug. So don't be that guy. So that's coming up Friday. This Friday, you will be able to submit your guess and Name That Snack once we've given out the fifth clue. So we'll do one clue every day this Friday. Once you get the fifth clue for the week, you're the first person to correctly respond. It's snack@rickemerson.com. You win a delightful heaping helping of things from EH Vending. So that's all coming up. And so forth. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Monday.
Yet another criminal discovers that hiding drugs between your buttocks does not work. A woman and a baby are bitten by a fox. And The Guardian reports that Julian Assange sometimes dressed as a woman to avoid surveillance.
Really? As opposed to just dressing for a woman to achieve the normal pleasurable sensations one has from being closer to the fairer sex?
Ostensibly, yes. No. He might have been doing it for other reasons, but, you know.
Okay. Well, there you go. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for drawing near. We don't want to get too terribly behind today because we should say, among other things, well, first of all, Mr. Ryan White, who's not only, you know, not only a journalist and a man about town and a man who's trying to steep himself in the world of the arts, also a new father. And so I feel like a dick kind of whenever we're running late. You know, like running late with like Jim or somebody. It's not like I feel good about it. But on the other hand, it's his day off. Also, he works at a porn store. So you get the feeling it's maybe a little bit of an elastic, environment there in terms of timelines. But so Ryan's got the new kid, so I don't want to get too behind. Also, today we're going to be joining Sarah X. Dillon and Greg Nibbler for another exciting episode of FunEmploymentRadio.com. That is coming up. I would imagine maybe 6 o'clock or so that gets posted today. Around 6 o'clock today, that is Monday, Don Taylor and I will be on with Greg and Sarah. Fun Employment Radio talking about a couple things, including the big game, which is coming up Sunday. Also, the fact that they're going to be doing a show for Trailblazers.tv, which is a thing about which I'm not at all filled with bitter envy. So all of that coming up. By the way, speaking of Greg and Sarah, at some point before they get in today and start drinking, I have to go and I have to get a shot. Remember when Anna Griffin was here from the Oregonian and we found out later that she was on TwitPic? She was on Twitter and she was putting up, it was like a series, I think it was the first day that she'd been on this show. She'd been on Outlook Portland, but not here. And it was a series of photographs. It was like, I am here, you know, like the Emerson News Network studios, whatever, like here's it. And it was like one shot of just all of the trash, like the bin of just like Foster's cans. And the other was just like caffeine. And one was just like a shot of like a lonely packet of mayonnaise in the fridge or something. So I don't know who the new tenants in this building are, and I don't mean that in a snarky way. I'm just saying I literally don't know who they are. There's some new business has moved into, some new firm is they are in this building somewhere. Because there was that woman this morning that I startled because I ran into the kitchen to grab my Vizo, and I was like, you know, avast! And I was running, bolting out of the door into the kitchen to get the Vizo, and she actually, I don't know if you could hear her or not.
No.
She actually did a little like, you know. Because we're just so used to this building, you know, it was just us for a while because it's not a big building. There's not a lot of spaces. There's only like, I think, 5 suites. And 4 of them are occupied, but the people are kind of never here. And there was really only one vacancy. Anyway, so they rented it out to somebody else. So I kind of started over this morning. But I could tell that there was somebody new in the building because if you look at the fridge now, I'll get a photo of this and post it at the rickemerson.com/pictures here in a bit.
Well, I did notice earlier there was soy milk.
It's, if you look in the fridge now.
I know that doesn't belong to any of us.
There's silky soft soy milk, I think it's called. And then is the orange juice yours?
No.
No, I didn't think so. So there's soy milk. And then there's a thing of like, you know, like Minute Maid or whatever, like 100% orange juice or something, which is, you know, helpful in a sense. So there's the soy milk. There's the orange juice on one side. And then literally on the other side is just nothing it's like there's just nothing but Mickey's and Rainier and Vizo, and that's it. It's like a perfect, like, Jets and Sharks. Like, they've divided the Brady Bunch house, like, right down the middle. It's awesome. So I'm going to get a photograph of that. So that really is, like, this building in a nutshell. So I'll get a picture of that taken. I had something else to say, but I forget what it was.
I don't know. You were talking about how you would watch a lot of movies this weekend, but I don't know if you want to get into that at this juncture.
I will say this, that if at some point today it sounds...
And you have no glasses on.
I was going to say, this is how my brain works. If it sounds like I'm squinting, is what I almost said. If it sounds like I'm squinting today, it's because I'm wearing my contact lenses, which is a thing I don't really do that all that often. And it's like I got contact lenses, but largely because I just had insurance for the first time ever, you know, or first time in a long time. And I'm like, yeah, I got insurance. I should just get everything done, you know. And I was just looking on the list of things they would cover. And I would just go, well, sure. Yes, 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 yes. I was like some sort of depression hoarder, but with healthcare. And it was like I would just get the thing done because, like, why not? You know, and it's like they would just, well, what's an ear scaling? I don't know. I guess I could use one. What's this? Bunion removal? Sure. And so I found out that...
Your anal glands expressed.
Exactly. It's like you were looking at my Franklin Covey for next week. but one of the things I found out is that they would cover contact lenses. Not 100%, but I mean very, very cheaply. And, you know, every now and again, you know, I wear contacts. Not that often again. Almost. Here's the thing. Of the times I've worn my contact lenses in the last 7 years, I think 80% of those have been like on Halloween when I would have some costume that precluded wearing eyeglasses.
Well, you may have a big audition coming up to play like an Irish police captain who doesn't wear glasses or something.
Thank you. That's nice of you to say, Dawn. I appreciate that. It's almost as though you said that for some reason other than mocking me. In any event, I got these contact lenses, and they just sit at home. And I got the glasses, then I got the prescription sunglasses, which are a thing that, here's the thing about prescription sunglasses. For the longest time, I viewed those as being sort of a luxury. Maybe they still are in the sense that, like, if you're in Rwanda, you probably don't have them. And I was going to say you get along fine, but that's also not true. But to me, they're sort of like a sunroof, in that I once viewed a sunroof as being a luxury. And then when I was relatively young... And it was in a cheap-ass car, too, a car I paid like $400 for. I somehow lucked into getting this car for just a few hundred dollars, and it had not just a sunroof, a moonroof as well, which is where you have the option of either just like where the ceiling itself sort of closes up and there's no light coming in, or you can open it and there's just the glass, so you just get the light, but it's not open. And I had that, and it was just, and I, from that point on, I was like, I can never again have a car that doesn't have a sunroof. It really is just one of the great, and I'm not like an outdoors guy. Like, I'm not a roll down the windows and feel the wind in your hair kind of guy, but the sunroof is awesome. The prescription sunglasses are like that. I don't know that I could go back to not having, especially because wearing glasses, I have to wear those big, like, Terminator X, huge, the Yoko Ono, like, things that fit over your glasses that they make for like Lance Armstrong or something. Like, I have to wear those otherwise. So the prescription sunglasses are really, really great. And I should have seen this coming, because speaking of auditions, I was headed to an audition, I don't know, like maybe last year or something, and I was there and I had my prescription sunglasses on, and I was just standing in front of the door waiting for them to buzz me up, not moving, just standing there, literally just immobile. And then, like, bink, one of the lenses just like fell out on the ground, and it was like for no reason because I wasn't doing jumping jacks or something. So that was like last year. I guess it would have been, what is today? Today is Sunday? So it would have been yesterday, Saturday. No, today is Monday. So yesterday, Sunday morning. I was just like at home. I was walking around, had my glasses on, and I've been up for a while. And I went into my office at home to do something or other, like to, I don't know, get a pen. And I think I actually was just stretching. I think it was sort of like a, and I stretched, and just one of the lenses of my eyeglasses just went wow, and just fell out and just landed on the ground.
Like you overflexed a face muscle.
Exactly. Sort of, yeah! And it popped, and then and then there's that thing where, like, you immediately panic, because even though you haven't moved, you're afraid you're going to step on it. And of course, not only did the lens of my eyeglasses fall out, and I don't have, like, a backup pair or anything, you know, because I'm dumb. So the lens fell out. But then, of course, the lens has fallen out because a screw has fallen out. Literally a screw loose. And so then the screw... But, of course, I don't know why they do this. Why, in the name of sweet Jehovah? First of all... All right, I'm getting all exercised about this. Is it possible that on my eyeglasses... That the screw, which, you know, because the way that eyeglasses are put together is it's a top piece and a bottom piece, and it goes together, mm-hmm. and then they screw it together at the ends, and that holds the frame in place. So it is like two halves, you know, divided top to bottom, and they put them together, and then you screw them together. Is it possible that the screw that holds the two side, the two pieces of the eyeglasses together, the metal frame together, on the right side, that that screw goes in upside down?
I suppose it's possible.
I don't think so. And in fact, I mean, I'm almost certain that it doesn't, because I think I looked at the left side to see, and it went in the top. But still, how would that screw just be gone? Like, how would they, because, of course, that's the thing, is the screw is just gone, too. It's not just the lens.
Well,
the screw is gone. They do loosen
over time, and then they pop out, and they're so impossible to find, because they're so tiny.
How would it pop out?
Well, because it slowly, if it loosens, it's, I have a problem. I have a pair of Ray-Ban sunglasses that were just ungodly expensive, and I cannot keep the screws in the temples, the thing that...
They work themselves free.
Yeah, they work themselves free, like, all the time. I just cannot keep screws in those things to save my life. You know, it's like probably about every 18 months, I'll lose a screw in on one side or the other.
What I don't get is I can get this sort of gradual loosening motion, because that's why, strangely enough, that's why they use Velcro a lot of times on plane parts, because Velcro gets tighter the more it vibrates and screws get looser. So I get the fact that the screw sort of gradually... I guess maybe if the screw gradually... untightens itself, if it gradually unscrews, then all it takes is the two halves clanging together and it goes and it hits the bottom half, hits the underside of the screw, and the screw pops out. And as you just said, the screw is like, it's like the width of a human hair. You're never going to find. Doesn't it seem like in 2011, and it's like, and I don't think it's planned obsolescence, because like how much money can there be in fixing a screw? It seems like if they wanted to jack me out of a few cents, they'd find a better way to do it. Why don't they have some alternate way to put together those glasses? And I know that somebody will say, well, why can't you weld the glasses together? The answer to that is, I think, because eventually sometimes you want to take the lenses out and put them in different frames. So, but I got to believe that there is some different way you can hold the lenses together. It's like a screwless means for holding the two sides of the frames together that would still allow you to take them apart at some point in the future if you wanted to put the lenses in something else.
You would think so. Or I don't understand why if I buy clothing, they will give me that little plastic thing with extra buttons. But when I spend like a few $100 for a pair of glasses, they don't give me spare screws.
That's a good idea. Somebody really ought to do that. That's
you
a really, really good idea.
You have to go to Walgreens and buy that little stupid thing, because with the tiny little screwdriver in it, and it comes with three or four screws, and then odds are that it's possible that none of the screws are actually going to be the right size.
Oh, don't get me started. So my wife...
Well, why don't they give you a thing with some extra screws, since, you know...
That is a really, really good question. That's one of the things they ought to do. Because, you know, like, you buy a shirt, they give you extra collar stays. You buy clothing, they give you extra buttons. You know, here's another thing, and I will get back to the eyeglasses here in a second. But, you know, here's another thing they ought to give you extra of. Let me just... And I know why they do this. This, sons of bitches, this is exactly the profit motive at work. The following thing, which is something that everybody in the last two or three years has probably dealt with at least once. This is a thing where a guy is just bending you over and he is just sodomizing you financially. They are just horking you for like $30. We all, over the last 10 years, have started using cell phones. We all, over the last 5 years, have started using MP3 players. We all, over the last couple years, started using smartphones, sometimes that consolidate several functions at once, like my iPod, also my MP3 player. We all, at the same time, realized that, like, those hard plastic earplugs, the earbuds that come with it, hurt like a mother effer. And so we all then made the transition to the silicone earbuds that go in. However, the silicone earbuds have the thing where the little silicone part will pop off. Then if you've lost it, you know, and if you've lost it on, like, one of them, then you're obliged to go to the store where you realize they don't really sell replacement, just silicone parts in most places. You have to buy a brand new goddamn set of earbuds for, like, $35. Here's the other thing they do, by the way, that has exactly this, zero point to this. There's absolutely no purpose unless you're like Sloth from the Goonies. You don't need two different sizes of silicone coverings for your earbuds. Because when you buy them, there's like a small and a medium and large, and like two of each. Why couldn't they just like offer them in a variety of sizes? And then when you buy that size, you get like two or three replacement sets. Because then they couldn't screw you out of $35 the first time you lose the silicone covering to the right earbud.
The Skull Candy ones that I bought, that I use.
Now that's what I have.
They came with a second set of
things. Now see, mine
things.
Did not. Mine came with a second and in fact a third set, but they were not of the same size. They were of an alternate size.
I assumed they were the same size. I didn't look.
Maybe they've changed it, because when I got those, it came with six of them altogether, three sets, and it was small, medium, and large, three different sizes. And again, maybe you got ears that are two different sizes, but probably not. So that is the thing. Where, and it's like you can't just use... The other really clever thing about those earbuds is if you lose the silicone covering, there's no way the thing will work with your ear at all. Like, it's not like you can just put the uncovered thing in your ear because it has that sharp... It just cuts the inside of your ear like into little pieces. So then you're just walking around with one of them dangling, you know, like what we used to call a re-knob. So you don't want to do that.
Or you do something... Like I have not come to this part yet. This has not been a problem for me yet. But I could see myself doing something like putting some duct tape around it or something.
You know what I did with the... my Skullcandy ones, which cost me, like, more than I even want to talk about? I actually was getting in the car, and it's like, you know, the Skullcandy thing, of, you know, for your iPod, the headphones, they also have the little microphones so you can be talking, you know, and hanging up and adjusting the volume. So I was getting into the car, I was at Fred Meyer, and it's like they had somehow trailed out of my jacket pocket, and as I shut the door shut at exactly the right point where it didn't catch anything. It didn't catch anything except the very, very ends of the earbuds, just the actual buds themselves, and just crushed them into powder. And then I just picked them up, and there's, like, sad wiring and, you know, pieces of plastic falling off. And I just sort of... And that was the thing where I became so angry that I was... It was like a wheel going so fast it's standing still, where I just went, well, okay, then. And I just wrapped them up, and I put them into the little jockey box next to the wheel. And I, okay, then I guess I'm just going to go to the mall. All right. Fantastic. Splendid day. Anyway, so this week... So yesterday, I'm walking into the eyepiece... The lens falls out of my eyeglasses. And then I immediately am like, oh, God, where did it go? And I'm afraid to move for fear that I'm going to go, where did it crunch? And then, you know, and step in the lake. Because that's the thing they'll just completely, like, they will just rape you for that when you go in to get that thing done. If you have to get one lens made. Because then they give you that jazz about how, I'm sorry, your prescription has changed ever so slightly on this one lens. I guess we'll just have to do both of them. Oh, you're slightly within the 18-month period. You're going to have to give us $500. So I'm like, okay, I got to find the lens. And then I have some vain hope. Then I'm going to find the screw for the earpiece.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. But, of course, it then turns you into, like, some horrible cocaine addict where I'm picking up everything that looks like it might. And, of course, I can only see with one eye. So I'm basically Sammy Davis Jr. at this point. I've got no depth perception. Every time I try to pick something up, it's either farther away than I think, and so I just waggle my hands like a T-Rex, or it's really close, and I go, boom, and I just hit my hand into something because I can't see how far away anything is. So I'm kneeling... I think in alligator boxer shorts. So I'm kneeling on the ground in alligator boxer shorts with one eye closed, feeling around on the ground like an idiot. So that was, and so there's no finding the thing. So I finally find the lens. And it's like, yesterday was Sunday. I forget what I even did yesterday, but I put on my contacts, because I had some stuff to do, and I think I had to go out or whatever. I went to the store or whatever, but I was afraid. I just didn't want to wear the lens outside of the house, and it's like, as it falls out again, then it is going to hit the pavement or the ground. So I'm like, you know what? And I can't wear my, my prescription sunglasses, because if I'm inside, I'm going to look like an a-hole, plus I'll be blind. So that I put in my contact lenses, which is great, except I haven't worn them for like a year. And the thing is, when you get contacts, you know, they do the thing of telling you, for the first day, wear them for an hour. For the second day, wear them for 2 hours. Of course, I wore them for like 12 hours yesterday, and at one point fell asleep. And then I woke up, like, sealed to my eyes. I'm afraid that the cornea is going to come out with it. And I'm, like, running my head under the tap. And by the time, like, 10 o'clock rolls around last night, I still got all this work to do. And I'm like, I cannot wear these contacts another day. My eyes are just, like, blood red. I'm like, oh, I got to take these out. It takes them. It feels like my eyes are full of sand, you know, and I'm putting them in the thing. And I finally got to do all my Outlook Portland prep. And so I'm like, okay, I have to stare at a screen for a while. I've got to put my glasses back on because I can't just, like, type using my sunglasses. That would be stupid. So what do I end up doing? Yes, my wife comes home later on. And I have just, first of all, it's that thing that you haven't done since grade school, but then you find yourself doing it, where you just get out the scotch tape and you have the long, dark tea time of the soul where you say, am I really about to do this? And then, yes, you are. And I'm just going, just taping up the earpiece of my glasses, just becoming a freaking Poindexter. But then I put them on and you forget about it. And then Lara comes home and she walks by the office and does sort of a double take. And she looks back and she just looks at me. And it's like, I've sort of forgotten that I have tape on my glasses. And she just looks and she says, really? And then she just walks off and just goes down to the basement and, you know, and presumably rethinks her choice of husband. And then I went, what? Oh, God. And then I went, and then I'd never actually looked at myself since putting them back on. And it's like you look in the mirror and you are a guy that has huge taped up eyeglasses. And it's just, you know, and you anyway, so that was, so then this morning I had to get up like 6 a.m. or whatever to go to Outlook Portland. You know, and it's so I've already had my contacts in for like 8 hours, which is like, I think, 7 hours longer than I should have them in today. So it's going to be a great day.
Yay.
Anyway, so that was my last night and this morning. And this is all true. We don't have time to talk about this now, but I watched a bunch of movies this weekend. I watched I'm trying to get all the Oscar crap watched.
That's the attitude.
Well, you know, A, because I like to be in touch with my own culture. As Stephen King says, you don't get brownie points for being out of touch with your own society. Also, because I have really gotten away from watching, I don't want to say current movies. It's not like I just watch old stuff over and over again. But I've gotten away from watching movies at even approximately the same time as the rest of the country. So, like, I'm now watching stuff from, like, a year ago. Like, I just for the first time, you know, like 6 weeks ago, I just watched The Hangover. So it's like I'm watching stuff that's current-ish. Yeah. But I'm not really watching stuff that's, like, you know, just out or out, like, within the last 5 or 6 months. So I'm trying to get a handle on that a little bit. Because you want to be able to, you know, as you said, to talk to people a little bit about, like, current movies while they're still current. Because otherwise you're, like, having to search around. It's like going on to play. Otherwise, it's like going on to play Connect 4 on Xbox and waiting there for an hour for somebody else to come into the game lobby, and that's never going to happen. So I'm trying to, you know, kind of stay caught up. And plus, the Oscars are coming up, and I want to know, you know, what the good people are voting on. So I saw this weekend, I saw two movies, and we should probably hold our thoughts on these. Do you want to know what I watched now and have to save your reactions, or do you want me to wait and tell you?
I'll wait and tell me.
All right.
I'll be all fresh and spontaneous-like.
So we'll go, because I have a question I want to ask you about something as well.
Okay.
We'll talk to Ryan White from The Oregonian here in just a minute. Coming up later on, Penis Watch, Snuff Watch, Democracy, The March, Pop Culture Authority, in which we answer the question, what's up with that creature in the Death Star trash compactor? And today's top five unintelligible pop songs. I'll go to the news desk. We'll do like 2 or 3 stories, then do the Pop Culture Authority, and then we'll break.
Okay, do we have time for that? Because
it's not even 2.
I know.
It's 1:59.
Isn't Ryan White here at 2?
Well, 2-ish.
Okay.
Let's just gesture toward news at least.
Okay.
That way I can feel like, wait, here's the thing. Here's why. Because then I can tell myself the lie that we are staying on schedule because we did show segments in order.
Okay.
Even though it was only for like, it's like a token sort of
All
news
right.
thing.
Okay.
All right.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Michael Anthony Fisher told Crestview, Florida police a lot of things when they found 3 pills on his person and 1.5 more when they searched his car during a traffic stop. The defendant advised he has a prescription for the pills found on his person, the incident report said. The defendant later stated, quote, where I'm from, they would smash those in the ground and then let me go.
What are the pills? Do we know?
The cops chose not to let him go. He was carrying hydrocodone. Which would be Vicodin,
right.
And they believed Xanax. So they took him to jail. There, according to the incident report, the Okaloosa County Department of Corrections found the defendant was concealing an item in his buttocks. The item was a plastic bag containing suspected marijuana and another pill.
I love the concealing an item in his buttocks, that some guy had to sit and type that sentence out and then just have a long moment of reflection about his life.
Yes. Fisher has been charged with possession of controlled substance, possession of paraphernalia, possession of marijuana, and introduction of a controlled substance into a secured facility.
Not his ass.
You can make
That's
your
not
own
the,
joke there.
Now, but I'm confused. Why did they arrest him?
Because he had controlled substances, which he said he had a prescription for, but he did not have any proof of the prescription.
Interesting.
Well, yeah. The thing is, like, I, for example, have a prescription for Vicodin. But if I get pulled over by the cops and they find me with a fistful of Vicodin—
And they're just in a regular bottle without your name on it.
Right. Which, to be honest, that's how most of us carry pills around,
yeah.
Is in just stuff. But the thing is, if it's not in the bottle with the prescription
with your
name on it—
They can't prove it's yours, or you can't prove it's yours.
Right.
And so the presumption is, like, you may have stolen these, or you may be trafficking.
Right.
Whatever. All right.
Because they presume that you're up to no good.
Yeah.
If they can't, if you can't prove you're not, because that's America.
Of course.
So, okay. Yeah. So
he hid things in. But in this case, he really was up to no good. So let me understand this, though. So he's got the Vicodin, and then whatever. But then in his ass, they also find a bag of marijuana and another pill.
And one pill, which I'm not
is
sure.
Is that like a super pill? That's the one that he really doesn't want them to
find.
Well,
that's the guy. I'm not sure if the pill – Mike, I'm assuming the pill must have been wrapped up in the baggie with the marijuana. Otherwise, wouldn't it dissolve from his, you know, the heat of his butt?
His area. Well, it is like a suppository effect, too. It's like almost you would think his body would maybe absorb it. He would have to have it wrapped up because otherwise, again, it would just sort of perspiration or whatever. Even if it's not like actually in there, it's like you figure it'll soak through your skin maybe or at least it'll crumble.
Yeah, it'll crumble, just be gone.
My thing, though, is why did he have just the Xanax out but like this one pill was so vital? Did the others just shake loose at some point?
It sounds to me like he's just very disorganized with his drug storage.
So we really have to keep it sort of like weed in the back, pills in the front.
Right.
Pills by the junk.
You need a mnemonic device.
A mnemonic device for that. So it's like grass in the ass,
pills in between the hills.
No, that doesn't really work.
That would be it.
Something in the crotch.
Yeah.
Tablets.
Yeah. Prescriptions.
Pills in the pants.
Yeah. Pills in the pants.
Grass in the ass.
Grass in the ass. Yeah.
Okay, we'll have to have some work done on that. That's
you can see why it was so difficult for him.
Seriously, and we're not even stoned.
Yeah.
All right. Here's Don Taylor.
We have a democracy on the march.
All right. We'll do this. Then we'll have a pop culture authority.
Okay.
Then we'll come back with Mr. Ryan White. Hold on. Here's your democracy on the march.
A state lawmaker from Marietta, Georgia, is sponsoring a bill that seeks to do away with Georgia driver's licenses. State Representative Bobby Franklin, a Republican from Marietta, has filed House Bill 7, calling it the Right to Travel Act. In his bill, Franklin states, "Free people have a common law and constitutional right to travel on the roads and highways that are provided by their government for that purpose. Licensing of drivers cannot be required of free people because taking on the restrictions of a license requires the surrender of an inalienable right." Franklin told CBS Atlanta News that driver's licenses are a throwback to oppressive times. "Agents of the state demanding your papers," he said. "We're getting that way here." CBS Atlanta's Rebecca Schramm asked Franklin, "How are we going to keep up with who's who and who's on the roads and who's not supposed to be on the roads?" "That's a great question," Franklin said. "And I would have to answer that with the question, why do you need to know who's who?" She asked, "What about 12 to 14-year-olds who want to drive? What would stop them?" And Franklin answered, "Well, what's stopping them now anyway?"
Okay. This is one of those stories where I started out pretty sure where I came down on the issue, and then now I'm just totally confused. I have no idea. I have no idea what I think and what I don't think. I mean, on the one hand, I'm for a guy who's reducing paperwork, but on the other hand, but also, like, it's not like I'm getting stopped by the Stasi on the way to my house every day, and they're like asking to see my stuff.
By the way, this guy, this would be Representative Bobby Franklin of Marietta, Georgia. His name is on the first 21 bills of the legislative session, including one that would require the exclusive use of gold and silver as tender in payment of debts by or to the state.
Oh, I see. I understand who we're dealing with now.
As required by the Georgia Constitution.
And by the little voices in Dale Gribble's head.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. There's your democracy on the march for awesome. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program here. In just one moment, we will be joined by Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian. Still to come today, we got your Peanuts watch, Snuff watch. I don't even know who died. People are just dying left and right. It's like I just can't walk out of the house without people dropping like flies around. Everybody I love dies, Don.
It is your fault.
It's true. So we've got all that coming up. Wait, is this the... how shall I put this? Will I be... Will I be shaken As opposed to anything else by the death of this person?
Indeed.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
All right, so we got Penis Watch coming up, Snuff Watch coming up. Later on, the top five most unintelligible hit songs. It's the top five thoroughly incomprehensible hit songs, as well as clue number one in this week's Name That Snack contest from E.H. Vending. In mere moments, you'll be treated to another exciting installment of Pop Culture Authority today. The question is, what is up with that creature in the Death Star's trash compactor? That is on the way. Stay right there. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program here on the Emerson News Network. Go nowhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
What was that creature in the Death Star trash compactor anyway?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Dawn Taylor. For persons of a certain age, it remains one of the most indelible moments in movies. The point when Luke, Leia, Han, and Chewie make an impromptu escape from the detention corridor on the Death Star, only to leap into a large, slimy, and very smelly trash compactor. It's a point in Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, when the very bad, being shot at by stormtroopers, becomes even worse as our heroes are trapped in a small, dark space where all they can do is bicker and claw at the walls. And then, with just a few short words, things get worse again, when Luke utters a line that gave young Star Wars fans more than a few sleepless nights: "There's something alive in here." As we all know, things got worse yet again in that trash compactor. The walls started to close in, with no apparent way to stop them. But as with all good matinee adventures, our heroes escaped with seconds to spare, rushing headlong into the film's third act, where the greater dramas of rivalry, loyalty, and sacrifice would fill screens around the world for the rest of the decade. In fact, it's only because the trash compactor scene is so well done, and also because it's a pivot upon which so much of the plot shifts, that we may not notice it's actually a mini-movie of sorts, and one that has nothing to do with space-bound fantasy. This is the 5 minutes when Star Wars Episode IV becomes a monster movie, and in the belly of the beast lurked another beast. George Lucas came from a generation of filmmakers who learned their craft in college, and thus had an academic, almost bookish knowledge of cinematic history. However, he also watched a lot of movies as a kid, and it was in the 1950s that American horror films began to shift away from Universal's gothic 1930s creature features and into something far more sinister: the horror of the unseen. Movies such as Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Thing from Another World grafted Cold War paranoia onto science fiction templates, while demonic horrors such as Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead suggested that evil forces were a moral contagion that lurked within. Should there be any surprise, then, that the creature in the trash compactor is heard and felt, but rarely seen? A single eye on a stalk emerges from the muck to peer at the interlopers, followed by a slimy tentacle that pulls Luke under. And then, with the clatter of underwater doors, it's gone. As it turns out, the creature is a Dianoga, a cephalopod that scavenges for trash. Was it put in the compactor by the Empire to eat rebel scum? Unlikely, since, according to Wikipedia, young Dianoga stow away on garbage ships as microscopic larvae, eventually growing to full size when well-fed, with a single eye on a stalk, seven tentacles, and a gaping mouth with inward-pointed teeth. They eat junk, not living things, and will only attack if frightened or forced to defend themselves. Had our heroes kept their bickering to a minimum, this particular creature may have presented no threat at all. As with most things in the Star Wars canon, the Dianoga have been extensively described, illustrated, and cataloged over time. And yet, the first good look that most youngsters had of the monster was not on screen or in comic books, but instead as part of Kenner's Death Star playset, released in 1978. And this was not some cheap cardboard diorama held together with plastic clips. Back in 78, the Kenner Death Star was the competition orange Corvette Stingray of children's toys, fully four levels tall with a working elevator, laser cannon, control room with drawbridge, and yes, a trash compactor. A working trash compactor with soft foam chips for trash and a lime green rubber Dianoga with an eye stalk, dorsal fin, two wings, and twin tails. And, of course, that big gaping maw of a mouth right in the middle of its chest. Naturally, seeing the Dianoga rendered as a small, bright green rubber object makes it far less terrifying than a monster attacking with lethal tentacles from the murky depths of a space station. However, reportedly, George Lucas was not entirely happy with the results of the Dianoga when Star Wars reached the screen, commenting to others that he had hoped for something larger and more ominous. If that's true, we can place the Dianoga alongside the great white shark in Steven Spielberg's Jaws and just be happy that neither director got his intended vision on the screen, but instead a narrowing of that vision, which in the end proved to be even more terrifying than the original concept. And let's face it, aside from the groundbreaking special effects, just three things elevated Star Wars from what would have been a very entertaining summer movie to something much closer to sheer cinematic delight. Harrison Ford's ad-libs, John Williams' score, and 5 minutes of human drama and unseen terror in an oversized, junk-strewn, utterly unforgettable trash compactor.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
If you want a good time, why don't you look me up? I never got the chance to make you mine. Why don't you look me up? I know you got my number around. Just call me up and we'll hit the time. Why don't you look me up? Why don't you look me up? Why don't you look me up? If you wanna have fun. I know you wonder what you're doing there. Why don't you look me up? He doesn't pay attention to. So where's his career? Why don't you look me up? I always hope we'd stay in touch. The other, 'cause I knew I don't miss too much. Why don't you look me up? Why don't you look me up? Why don't you look me up? If you wanna have.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. There's a big thing sitting next to you.
Yes. Yes, there is.
Did you bring a parrot or something with you?
No, I brought a visual aid because I believe we were talking about the Death Star.
Oh! Wow! Okay, what a fool I am. A, that I didn't ask about that earlier. How did I not notice? Has that been there the whole time, covered up with black, like, sackcloth?
Indeed it has.
I thought you had a hostage.
I was waiting. I was trying to figure out, like, what I was going to say if you asked what that was. And I was like, it's my lunch. I don't know. It was just here when I got here. I couldn't think of what I was going to say.
We should say, by the way, we're joined by Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Okay, here's the thing. I don't know. Maybe it's because it was covered with sort of a black sort of cloak thing, and it was up against a black wall in what is admittedly a pretty dimly lit studio to begin with, that I didn't notice it. And I'm glad, because if you had said, like, it's a baby.
I think I was just going to go.
Somebody lent me.
I think I was just going to go, that's for later, just ignore it now.
I would have figured it out, I think. I'm glad I didn't. By the way, points for just, I wish that we had been filming it when you go like, well, does this answer your question? So it is. That is a full on, that is a vintage Death Star.
It is indeed.
Oh, man.
And I got guys, you know.
Now where did you get this? Whose is this?
Well, the original plan was I was going to bring this in and I was going to say, oh, a friend of mine gave me this for Christmas. Isn't this cool? And then watch you be burning with paint. But actually, this is my friend Bobby Wiederquist.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I met him.
He loaned me this. And this is his childhood Death Star.
This is the one he actually had as a child?
Yeah, and apparently it is in just extraordinarily good condition, as he told me.
I'm not going near
because
it.
Because as a child, he just really liked putting it together and then taking it back apart. That most kids would get the thing and their parents would like put it together and then they go bash, bash, bash and break everything. And he would like get all the guys together and go, come on, Chewie, let's build the Death Star. Like, okay. And then his joy would be in putting it together. And then once it was all built, it would be like, okay. And then he'd take it back apart carefully and then put it away.
And unsurprisingly, he is, among other things, a software engineer at this point. Because the engineers don't ever like to use anything. They just like to build it, take it apart, build it again.
But, like, there's all his guys, and he's got, like, Boba Fett. And,
wow.
And these are the original Kenner.
Those are the... Well, and you can tell they're the originals because they're not all roided up like everything later became.
And this section here... Here is the trash compactor.
Oh, okay. Hold on. Where's my? I gotta be taking photos of this. Hold on a second. So this is, and I get my get my.
And this
snap
is the this is the actual original foam pieces that are the foam trash for the
God,
trash compactor.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And there's a trap door here, and so from the actual Death Star thing, you could drop guys down into the trash compactor through the thing.
Oh, that really is. Pardon me while I nerd out here. So let's see. I'm gonna get a. All right, that's fantastic. So we got that.
And then here's how you would actually turn the thing to compact the trash and to put them in peril.
All right, now before we get a reveal on what was the creature called that
the
lived
Dianoga.
In... All right, hold on. Before we get to that, I gotta get a shot of the actual Death Star itself here.
Oh, no.
Hi, we're all 50 years old.
This, by the way, is bringing back all of my childhood, like, inadequacies and insecurities because the kid in the apartment upstairs had one of these and I didn't.
Of course. Well, I was just actually... Okay, see, now it all makes so much sense, you damn woman, because I was, during the break, so Ryan White came in and we were talking about the Death Star and I said that my bastard cousin, who always got, and I've mentioned it before, he always got two of everything. And I think that's just because he was just a little hooligan, and his parents, my aunt and uncle, knew that he would inevitably just, like, he would get the thing and then he would break it instantly. What does this piece do if I push it in the wrong direction? Kunk. And so his parents would just buy him duplicates of toys. And so he had I don't know if he actually had two Death Stars, but he had like all the Star Wars stuff. And I remember the trash compactor with the little foam pieces, but I didn't remember the Balrog or whatever the thing is that lurks inside of it. And Don said, well, we should talk about this when we come back. And I actually almost said, like, that was a very brusque way to end my conversation about the Death Star from Kenner. What are you doing? But now I understand. It is, oh, there was a master plan. Wow.
The Death Star is so cool. Like, this is an actual working elevator. The thing turns, and you can put the guys in there.
And it's a working elevator.
And then the elevator goes up, and it stops at each floor. And you can put the little thing here to keep it at that floor so they can go
does
in
the,
and out.
Does the laser gun make noise, the laser cannon?
No.
Okay.
No.
Let's see. Hold on. I hate to be this guy. I really have to post something on Twitter about it right now.
Okay. And then there's the...
Do I dare? I can't type OMG in good... I just can't.
you can.
Okay. OMG. Let's see. I'm just... sorry, everybody. We'll just resume here in just a second. Don Taylor... just brought a let's see, I'll just say a vintage a near flawless vintage Death Star. Near vintage let's see. Awesome.
And you were asking what I did with my weekend, and one of the things that I did with my weekend that I couldn't say at the time was last night I sat there with the instructions trying to figure out how to put this together, which wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. Also, you've got, like, all of the little figures have little holes in the bottom of their feet, and they're little pegs where they can stand at the controls and things like that, so Chewie can stand
there
and do things.
All right. I'm going to post this right here.
And Ryan White is using the trash compactor
Wow, that really is fantastic. And Kenner was that the thing where the supply could not meet the demand, and so when you buy a Kenner figure, you would actually get like a certificate inside that actually it was like for the Christmas of 77, and it said something like, "Sorry, you know, but like we don't have any more figures. You can redeem this like in a month when we get more of them made or something."
I think that sounds right. That sounds good.
Picks coming soon.
Yeah, everybody's in really good shape. All the little guys too. Although Bobby was pointing out though that the weak point on these was the little vinyl capes didn't really
Was the other thing, and then plus
although
the
Greedo still has his coat
and the lightsaber would always bend, the tip of the lightsaber got all bent up, plus that little snake that went around Yoda's neck, cuz he had the felt cape too, which would tear, but the snake around Yoda's neck, you would always take it off and then it would just you know.
And there's Boba Fett, and I think he's worth about $7,000 or something, probably on eBay.
I don't even want to touch any of those things.
Still got Yoda's belt.
That's the Yoda. See, he's missing the snake, though. There should be a little orange snake that wraps around. Did you have Star Wars stuff growing
up? Oh, yeah. My parents still have, there's one of those down in the basement. I had the Darth Vader-shaped carrying case for all of mine, and my brother had the C-3PO, and they're both still down in my parents' basement.
He needs to play with the trash compactor, because he has talked about how much he wanted to play with
this. This is the best thing you've ever done for me, Don. All right. Hello, Ryan White. How are you? How's life?
Life's good.
Did you say that you're due for another ear infection at your home? Is that how you measure life when you're a parent? Is it like rings in a tree? You just say, this was ear infection 7.
Well, we've had 2 in 3 weeks, and I think we're clear of the second one, so hopefully we're free of them all for a while now. I think we're all just going to be sick for the rest of the summer, though.
You're just sort of your
winter or whatever it is.
You're kind of zen with it. All right, I'm getting a photo of
Dianoga.
Dianoga.
Dionysus.
Right. Yeah, that's. I keep wanting to say that, and then I wanted to say Balrog, and that's wrong too. So. Wow.
Yeah, apparently this
Dionysus and ball gag.
Apparently this Death Star is completely intact except for two things. There's supposed to be a little plastic rope that was what Luke swung across on the one thing, because here's the thing and there's a thing.
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
missing. And then I guess this is missing something that helps it ratchet back and forth, but
that really is fantastic. Now I have no idea what the answer to this question is, but there we go. Okay. I guess I'm done taking photographs.
I guess
what does this go for?
I think he said that a fully intact one in the box, which he doesn't have the box, but I think if you can find one, I think it's worth about $1,500.
See, I'm actually surprised it's that low if you can find it in the box. I'm amazed.
But then there's all the individual figures, too, and I have no idea what people ask for the figures.
And it's strange how certain figures escalated. We could do an entire show on this. I say as though there aren't like podcasts probably who just spend, this is all they do. But I am amazed at the disparity in price attached to certain Star Wars figures. And I know this is like baseball cards and everything like this. But I mean, I think part of it has to do with like the scarcity and then also just the sort of fetishization that happened like with Boba Fett, where Boba Fett just became the guy everybody liked for reasons that were never really, I guess it was because he was so mysterious because you didn't know he was just...
I guess.
Because you didn't know he was just a freaking clone or whatever, or underneath. He seemed really, really, seemed really sort of dark and mysterious, and he was full of intrigue and he had like Wookiee pelts or whatever, like around his waist that he would wear, some of those things. It's like the things you would never think of too. Like what's this? What's a power droid? And the power droid, I think, is just that thing that hops around inside the scrap collecting vehicle on Tatooine when the Jawas get R2 and they put R2 and C-3PO in the little thing. And I think the power droid is the thing that just hops around.
Well, yeah, there's these things here, and I was like, oh, look, it's R2-D2, and Bobby was like, no, this is R2, this is...
That's the R2 unit with the bad motivator.
Yeah, this is, yeah.
That's like R5 or something like
I'm sorry.
That.
It's the R2 unit with a bad motivator!
By the way, things you don't realize when you're a kid, Yoda looked really stoned in his figure. Look at those eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Yoda.
That's is it true that they made Yoda's
pass the blunt, will you?
I guess I'm thinking of E.T., I guess, where they made E.T. by putting, like, Einstein's eyes on a baby's face or something. It's like some weird...
Really?
Or it was the opposite, where they put a baby's eyes on Einstein's face, and that's how they made E.T. Hmm. His facial features, the combination of Albert Einstein and a baby. And I don't know if Yoda comes from anywhere in particular in terms of his, like... Of all the days, by the way, for Aaron Duran to not be able to do his Weekend Geek slot. Wow. Wow, wow.
Remember the 3PO, the Jedi era 3PO that you could take the arms and the legs off of?
No.
So he'd be like the dude in the Metallica 1 video, but a robot?
No, I don't remember that, actually. That's the there's a couple things, actually, that people have referenced that I don't remember seeing, and then there are a few things that I remember that other people, like the Power Droid was one, and I think I made an IG-88 reference the other day, and IG-88 was this tall robotic bounty hunter. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to somebody about that, and he immediately like whipped out his iPhone and had to like go to some Star Wars site that he had bookmarked because he couldn't quite remember what IG-88 looked like. That really is fantastic. You got to thank Robert for letting you bring that in. That is that is something. I had the see, and the thing is, and I kind of got all of these things. I got the Star. I've mentioned that my Star Wars viewing experience was similar to but different from most people of my generation. Unlike most sort of the Gen Xers and nerds of every stripe, I did not see any of the Star Wars films in the theater, the original trilogy anyway. I didn't see any of the episode 4, 5, 6. I didn't see any of those in theater until the special editions came out because my mom was going through this real hardcore Christian phase in her life, and she was going through a real kind of zealot period. And it was a whole thing of like the only force in the universe is Jesus Christ. And so I wasn't, you know, and it was like, I'm like 7. So it's not like I can really just like, I'm taking the car, you know, because that guy in Alabama hadn't quite made it legal for me to drive yet.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate in that I was not totally deprived. My kid who lived across the street, his dad traveled a lot for business, including traveling overseas. And they had two things. One, one of the early Betamax VCRs. And his dad would travel and he would bring back, I don't know if it was China or whatever, but he would travel to Asia for business and do a lot of other places. But he would bring back like really, I don't say they were early bootlegs, but I mean, they're probably the first bootleg thing, video things I ever saw. And it was a forerunner of what you have today, where there would be like a guy with a, you know, 15-pound video camera in the back of the theater, where they probably weren't looking for that sort of thing, so it might have been easier to do. And it would be like the shaky sort of like handy cam version of The Empire Strikes Back. And sometimes it would be weird. It would be like in English with like Mandarin subtitles or something. So I would see all of the Star Wars films, and I think also maybe Raiders of the Lost Ark, like maybe 6 months or something after they came out, and I would see them across the street. And it was the same thing, or you'd watch them over and over again, but it was not quite the same experience. So I never got like the theatrical, like seeing, you know, in the opening of New Hope when the huge like Carillion freighter or whatever it is like comes and fills the screen. Like I kind of missed out on that whole thing. And then the Star Wars figures, of course, I would always get late because my cousin would move on to some new toy, and he would discard with his old toys. So like when he got like his Empire stuff, like he'd get rid of Star Wars stuff. When he got rid of his Jedi stuff, he'd get rid of his Empire thing.
Wow.
And then I'd get like hand-me-down toys. And there are worse things in the world than hand-me-down Star Wars toys. But it's like, you know, so I was sort of a little late to the party in these things. And then I had the old, you know, the classic story of then I moved away from home and my mom sold everything in a paper bag stapled shut that said $5 on the front of it. So, you know, so there's some guy out there that's, you know, is just laughing all the way to the bank with all of my many, many, many collectibles. So there you go. Anyway, I am fascinated by the guys who have the stuff in the box, though, from 77, because it's like, why would you? Why would you have kept it in the box at 77? There was no collector's market to speak of. You wouldn't even have imagined that.
You're like the most obsessive compulsive child ever.
Or if just you just forgot about it, you know? Or like if it's just like if your dad, you know, bought it for you, if you bought it for a birthday present and you somehow like forgot to give it to the guy and then you find it in your basement like, you know, 10 years later.
I guess.
I mean,
yeah.
I could.
I went through this thing where I sold all my Barbie stuff on eBay.
When you were how old?
Collectors. Oh, just a few years ago.
Oh, okay. I guess on eBay it would have been recently.
Yeah, and it was it was interesting to find out like, you know, just how much.
Did
like,
you get a lot for it?
Yeah. It was actually at the very beginning. This was probably about 12 years ago because it was just when eBay was really kicking off. So it hadn't completely just like depressed the market for collectibles yet. So I did something like I sold some Pez dispensers that I had, including I had one that was a Mickey Mouse Pez dispenser from when I was a little kid. And it was one of the like first Mickey Mouse Pez dispensers that had no feet. Because apparently the original Pez dispensers had no feet on the bottom to help them stand up. And so those are more valuable. And some guy gave me like $125 for my Mickey Mouse.
Wow.
Pez
and did you immediately think like, I'm sitting on a gold mine here?
Yeah. I had a Bullwinkle Pez dispenser as well that I'd also had since I was a kid. And somebody gave me $75 for that. And I sold my first Barbie. And the Barbie sold for a ridiculous amount of money. And then separately from that, I still had basically my case for all my Barbie stuff, which was – it was a big plastic case that latched shut, kind of like, you know, guys have for guy, right. guy toys too. But you open it up, and then if you stood it up on its side – it was Barbie's apartment. You could like pull down two beds and you could hang the clothes up and it was a closet and it was awesome. And somebody paid me some stupid amount of money.
Wow.
Did you take the Pez money and go buy a bunch of the little Pez candies? Because I think that's what I would have done.
I still have something like 65 Pez dispensers, by the way.
I would get the Pez dispenser and just throw it aside and start unwrapping the candy that came with it and just start eating that.
It really is. It is kind of fascinating, the idea that, you know, that you – and it's never the stuff you anticipate. Like it's not – you know, like it's nothing from like Revenge of the Sith or whatever. It's not just going to be valuable because everybody's saving that thinking it's going to be valuable. So by definition, yeah. It's like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. By saving it, you remove any chance that you'll ever be able to unload it for any amount of money or whatever. You mentioned the Darth Vader carrying case for the toys. I had a similar thing. I don't think this stuff is nearly as valuable, but I had a lot of were like Hot Wheels cars, like Matchbox mm-hmm. cars. And there was Hot Wheels, in fact, made a knockoff, sort of a variation on the Darth Vader thing, where it was like a huge radial tire or something you would carry. That, and that's the stuff that is valuable. It's like the ancillary item, the carrying case, because nobody saves the carrying case. I had the most fascinating experience. This is a long time ago. Now, this is probably 10 years ago. But I was at a Toys R Us somewhere. It might have been here, but I don't think so. I was at a Toys R Us somewhere, and I just happened to be there. I wish, in retrospect, I wish I had done something, taken a photo of it or did whatever. But I was at a Toys R Us, and some guys had like gone into like the attic or like some way down in like the catacombs of the Toys R Us where like the deep storage stuff is kept, or like the, you know, or like the janitorial supplies and everything is just sort of ensconced in this dusty corner that nobody ever goes to. But they were looking for something or other in the basement of the Toys R Us or in the attic or in some storage facility that wasn't really used all that often. And the guy came out holding this big cardboard box, and he was doing the whole movie thing like going and blowing the dust off of it and says North Pole Expedition 1852. But it was a case of Atari video games. And it was all sports games for some reason. And a lot of them, there was really only like three games inside. There was like 20 of each. It was like Atari boxing and Atari like 2600 basketball and like, I don't know, something else like slalom skiing or some crap. But it was a case of those things from like 1978 or whatever. And it's not like those are really going to be valuable because there was a glut on the market. But that was fascinating, the idea that those had just sat there. And it makes you wonder if like back in 1978, if there was like a whole lot of like fist fights that broke it. You told me you ordered it! Wham! You know, and there was some guy couldn't get a slalom game. And so he had to go home and just spend all night drinking because he was going to disappoint his children in the morning. And it's like then the guy just happens to stumble across it years later. And it's a strange slice of the American consumer mind, the collecting of these things. That is fantastic. Excellent. Well, thank you for bringing that in, Don. That's awesome. And that is a fantastic pop culture authority, by the way. That's one of the best we've had. So well done. Ryan White, we'll get some news here in a moment. We got the Penis Watch coming up, Snuff Watch, we'll do the top five most unintelligible hit songs and top five most incomprehensible hit songs and so forth. What is up in your world, sir?
What is up in my world? Story yesterday on Rodney Crowell's new memoir.
He's coming to town.
He is coming to town in a week and a half. I was watching this as I was, you know, I read, it's a great book. He wrote about his parents and his childhood. It has almost nothing to do with music other than you get that, you know, his dad took him to his first Hank Williams concert and you've got all these really complicated characters. I mean, his dad was a drunk who would beat his mom and, you know, kind of you see him throughout his life sort of redeem himself and through that. But I was watching some Rodney Crowell videos on YouTube, and I came across this one where he was doing something. I think it was after Johnny Cash had died, and he had been Johnny Cash's son-in-law for about 13 years. He was mm-hmm. married to Roseanne, and he was talking about having been, when he and Roseanne moved in together for the first time, having been summoned by way of two plane tickets to Jamaica, where Cash had this, had his estate. And Rodney Crowell says, "So what do you do when you've been summoned to meet Johnny Cash?"
Seriously.
"Well, you drink 14 Bloody Marys on the airplane, and that's from Los Angeles to Miami, and then we switch to rum." He goes, "So we get down there, and I'm in one room, and I hear Roseanne talking to her dad, and I screw up my courage, and I walk in there drunk and say, I'd be a hypocrite if I behaved any different here than I did at home, so we're sleeping together." He goes, and John looked up at me and says, "Boy, I don't know you well enough to miss you."
Wow. That's awesome. That is a – and the thing is, and you hear that and you just – you immediately know that that's true. And you don't doubt it at all.
And so Crowell says, you know, for any of you fathers of daughters who will one day have to deal with a drunken boyfriend, there's your line. Because it stops
totally.
You cold.
What is – I have lost track of Rodney Crowell. I don't even know – I'm not even really sure what he's been up to, if he's been recording.
He's been putting
out
some really good records the last couple of years. It was interesting when I talked to him for the story on the book was that his last few albums have been really, really locked in the present. In 2001, he wrote a record called The Houston Kid, which had a lot of kind of more autobiographical songs that were clearly about his family and his mother, a song called The Rock of My Soul. And it turns out that he started writing this memoir about 10 years ago. He said it took me 7 to figure out that I could write in sentences and 3 more to figure out how to get it right.
And he's
from there.
And he's going to be the Aladdin.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's sometime in the next.
I think it's the 8th. I think it's the night I'm going to see Trombone Shorty, so I'm going to miss that one.
He's one of those guys that I always feel sorry for because he's on the other side of the Aladdin sign that I never see if I'm just coming to work or if I'm like going across the bridge or something. I actually had gone to the post office this morning over at on 17th by the Twilight, and that requires you to sort of do like you can't really get back on Powell, and so I had to loop around, and then that happens to me like maybe once every 6 weeks, and then and only then will I see like whoever else is coming to the Aladdin. I was feeling like that really is getting the fuzzy end of the lollipop if you're one of those guys. We should do this. Let's go to the news desk. This is Don Taylor,
and now from the news desk. This is Don Taylor.
We have a Hick Watch.
All right, here is your Hick Watch for Monday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Copenhagen, the way I know it should. Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering on around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good.
Here's Don Taylor with your Hick Watch. This is the story that has the sound.
Yes.
All right.
Animal control officers in Pilot Mountain, North Carolina, are on the lookout for a fox that bit an elderly woman and a one-year-old girl. The girl's parents were taking a walk when the fox attacked on Saturday afternoon. This is the girl's father, Chris Bottoms.
Well, I picked her up, and it still had a hold of her, so I kind of, like, twirled around with her, and then it let go, and I backed away, and it started coming at me. And that's when I kind of hauled off and kicked it.
As Bottoms and his wife were taking the girl to the hospital, the fox struck again just up the street. An elderly woman...
Like it's a master criminal, like it's a jewel thief.
An elderly woman, Jane Sisk, said she was sitting on her back porch when the fox bit her on the leg.
Doing some whittling.
I was sitting on the back porch steps. And the two dogs was out there.
Oh, God.
And I saw something else coming, and it was that old fox. And he just, I was fixing to get up, and he scraped my leg.
She says if it wasn't for her dogs, the attack may have been worse.
They didn't get attacked, but they was barking at him. He was kind of smiling at them. Ugly old thing.
Here's the funny thing, by the way, is that as we were getting ready to do the show today, Don said, I've got this story, but I don't really know if it's a Hick Watch or not.
I wanted to give these people the benefit of the doubt just because they have an accent.
Is that your whole thing? Is like the Southern twang itself does not denote that it's
no,
a Hick Watch?
It seems Hick Watch should involve, I don't know, trailer park behavior of some sort. Just being bit by a fox.
I think the claim you actually made before the show was, well, that could happen to anybody, anywhere, which isn't really true. I think I've gone 37 years. The old fox hasn't bitten me.
But, you know, the thing was with her saying, you know, it was a coming at me.
And it's like,
that old fox.
And exactly. Like he's a sort of rapscallion you see around the neighborhood, you know, like old man Jenkins when he's had one too many Bloody Marys.
Waiting for one of them to say that it sounded like George Clooney.
Totally. I mean, right. It's they have the whole anthropomorphization that goes on with the fox where it is like he's Carlos the Jackal or something.
Oh, Mr. Fox was a coming at me.
God.
Like I hate to quote Jeff Foxworthy, but the one thing that he's ever said that really made me laugh was he was pointing out one time that Southerners aren't dumber than everybody else. They just can't keep the dumbest of themselves off television. He goes, you know, you'll see a tornado come through town and there'll be one guy on TV going, oh, you should have seen it. We could have been killed or even worse.
That's fantastic. I got to hit just one more with the...
I was sitting on the back porch steps and the two dogs was out there and I saw something else coming. And it was that old fox.
Okay. I can count on zero fingers, by the way, the number of times I've ever had to twirl around in the living room because some sort of wildlife is in the living room and it's got a hold of one of my kin. It doesn't really ever happen to me.
Well, yes. Officials think the fox may have rabies. They set out traps. If the traps don't work, officials said they'll simply put out more. Both victims are expected to recover.
Okay. There you go. Big watch.
Copenhagen makes me feel so good. Copenhagen, the way I know it should. Well, I put a little chew in my mouth, go spitting, slobbering all around the house. That Copenhagen makes me feel so good.
I'm wondering if you could do a top five of songs about Copenhagen, because I can think of one other one right now.
Really?
Yeah, there's a Robert Earl Keen song called Copenhagen.
And
the fact that Don got that last sentence out before losing it is one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
Why would they? I mean, I know that there must be some logical explanation behind that. There's got to be
and
some.
And then we'll put more out. If those more don't work, then we'll do the morest.
By the way, I'm gonna hand you back this Death Star trash compactor because I am so desperately afeared that I'm going to break it somehow, and then I have to kill myself.
Okay.
Or that's the thing where I have to replace it by the end of the day, and it becomes a whole like Curb Your Enthusiasm thing where I got to go like beat up a kid and steal his Star Wars.
The
toys.
Trash compactor part is actually pretty
sturdy.
It's pretty hardy. The dangerous thing is dealing with the rest of this because it's all just a matter of like. All of these different layers are held together with these plastic struts.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like I'm just so afraid that I'm going to like, you know, knock it over and something will snap in half.
That's the thing is like if you lean on that, if it, you know, top down pressure is one thing on that Death Star, but if you were to give it some sort of a sideways push, yeah, those will just they'll snap off at the beams. You don't want to do that. This is similar to, but different than the G.I. Joe Command Fortress, which I had when I was a wee lad, and it was the same thing where it was amazingly detailed. I mean, and really, I was going to say that things like this are not really made for children now, and I guess they're not. But that's also because they have like. Because they have computer-based, they have computer-based playthings of an almost otherworldly power. So the idea that they're going to be, you know, impressed by a piece of molded plastic that vaguely approximates a big thing in the real world is probably not, you know.
We've got a stuffed dog with a US that comes with a USB cable in our house.
Really?
Yes.
What does it do?
It sings, and you type in like the kid's name and favorite food, and so it'll sing things like, you know, it'll end a song like, and I'll call it. Stella, just like you.
Are you afraid she's going to go for some totally warped idea of how dogs actually operate?
I haven't thought that far ahead yet. It's just so funny. Like my wife and I will just crack up. You know, you squeeze a paw and it'll say something. It'll be like, I love you, Stella.
Do you remember the really, really early iterations of that toy where it would be like some? It would be like a teddy bear, and the deal is like you would squeeze the paw. And then its nose would blink or something, and that was when you had like a 4-second window to record like a whole, you know, like I love you, Grandma, you know, and then she could press it back and it would.
Or the Teddy Ruxpin, the tape in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it the Thermals who like last year when they were touring the East Coast were urging people to bring them Teddy Ruxpins to the show? It was like the Teddy Ruxpin Thermals tour. I think it was them.
You mean just as like to do like an on stage sort of.
Like if you brought them a Teddy Ruxpin, they would let you in for free or something like that. And they had like a.
Wow.
They were trying to collect a van full of Teddy Ruxpin while on tour.
Okay, we totally have to think of something that we've been trying to track down. We have to think of some sort of collectible item and then just institute some sort of a swap policy for that.
My friend Jeff, who I mentioned before, he was the guy who did the thing about, you know, corn is a fruit.
Right.
Syrup grows on a bush on Parks and Recreation. He did a story for the Mother Goose that was like the Teddy Ruxpin, and it was a thing about the shoemaker and the elves. And there are few things weirder than hearing like someone you know's voice come out of an animated goose going, I'm the shoemaker, then they make the shoes, and the shoemaker's going, ha ha. And he was doing this horrible German accent and singing a song about shoes. And it was all coming out of a goose's mouth.
There's apparently... a couple things. A, our good friend Tim Riley, whose birthday I believe is today.
Indeed.
So
yes.
Happy birthday, Mr. Tim Riley. So I believe that he is the voice of, well, first of all, he's the voice of some show that only aired like in Singapore, where it's like an animated bear family. And it's like they sing and they learn lessons and they do something or other. And Tim is like the voice of like one of the bears or whatever. Sarah Dillon is actually the voice of an exhibit that started at OMSI. It's called the Moneyville exhibit. And it's a sort of interactive thing for kids where you go through and, you know, it's like, you know, where money is printed and, you know, how they make coins and, you know, where our system of currency comes from. But it's a huge exhibit you walk through. And then there's like things where like the bills will talk like, you know, I'm Ben Franklin. And at the time, we had a listener who was the art director at OMSI. And so she recruited, you know, she was like looking for people to come do voices. And so Sarah is the voice of like, I don't know, she's the voice of like, you know, Molly Mint or whatever, who explains like how it is that they strike like bronze and silver or whatever to make coins. Greg Nibbler, on the other hand, really everybody but me, Greg is the voice of, he's the voice of something as well. He is the voice of, apparently there's this thing they do, and we'll have to ask him today when we're on Fun Employment Radio. I guess there's something they do at schools back east where it's like some, it's like a sort of multimedia math teaching program. It's like something that kids, it's like partially video and partially like textbook and partially like, I don't know, online or something. But it's, Greg is the voice of like this math program. And I don't think it's like a mascot or like a character. I think he like is the voice of the math program. And they give him a name like, you know, Ted or something. But it's for like, it's like a 3-year course. So there's going to be this whole generation of kids that have grown up knowing Greg Nibbler as like a voice they deal with every day at school, which is bizarre.
Wow.
Because see, then the great thing about that is like 20 years from now, that's like money in the bank because he can go on some show like this one, you know, and just, you know, and be hawking some sort of like a cookbook or whatever. But just all based on the hook that he was like, hey, remember this voice, kids? So he'll be like the Oregon Trail guy. You know, he can just fund the rest of his life on that. All right. Here's Don Taylor.
3 Orlando, Florida residents.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida, of course. Have been arrested after they reportedly stole diapers and then tried to resell them. On January 21st, detectives in the Osceola County Sheriff's Office Tourist Policing Unit were conducting an undercover investigation in the area where residents had reported several burglaries when the detectives noticed 20-year-old Marvin Brown driving away from the scene of an attempted burglary. A few days later, the detectives saw Brown, 22-year-old Antoine Smith, and 18-year-old Marquita Brown drive to a Babies R Us, where the 3 stole several boxes of diapers. The 3 then drove to the Windsor Cove Apartments in Orlando, where they sold the diapers. On January 26th, the detectives again followed the 3 to the store when the Browns and Smith exited the store with more stolen diapers.
When you say they drove to the Windsor Cove Apartments, and by the way, that's one of those places that you know exactly what it looks like by dint of the name that they have given. It's like when they call something like Estates or Manor.
You know, there's no cove.
No, Foxwoods. And you just know that it's a hole.
Yeah.
So when they drove to the the Windsor Cove Apartments and sold the diapers. Do you mean like they walked in and there was a guy there who was going to buy them? Or they like went in and they set up like a lemonade stand, basically, where they were just sort of, come on by the Windsor Cove this afternoon. Get yourself some diapers.
Yeah, that's what I imagine. It's like just opened up the back of the station wagon and all of these moms came down and bought discount diapers.
It's like a guy selling mixtapes out of his trunk.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's like that guy that comes to your business and goes, we were unable to sell all of these fountains with the dancing bunnies, and my boss said we got to get rid of them by the end of the day. So I'm going business to business to give you – get out of my store. Just get off of my land. All 3 have been booked.
Strangely angry. Some sort of personal relevance there. Get off my land. Who's the hick now?
I used to work.
Northern aggressor.
I used to work in an office where these people would come in all of the time, and the ladies who worked at the front desk would actually, you know, buy crap from them. And I'd be just sitting there, and I'd be on the other side of this partition trying to edit news stories and stuff. And then one of them would call back and go, do you want to buy some animated bunny toys from this fella? And I would say something like, I would rather have hot pokers jabbed into my eyes. And then everyone would laugh. And I said, no, really, get out. You know, and
just picturing coming out with like a blunderbuss.
It would just make me angry.
Here's the thing about that is that when I was, this is years and years ago, but this is when I was between radio gigs at one point, I was at that stage where I was going through the newspaper. And so everybody's been at this place at one point or another in their lives where you're just circling like everybody who is hiring for any kind of job at all. It's just the whole like, you know, like, you've gotten to the point where it's like the brother just got to eat. Doesn't matter what, you know, and it's like any, you know, no experience necessary. Bam. And you circle it. And I went to some, and I should have known better in retrospect, you know, because the wording of the ad was sort of like, you know, sales position, no experience necessary. And I, you know, I had no idea what it was, but it was exactly one of those places where it's like, and it was sort of like some horrible, It was like some horrible cross between Glengarry Glen Ross and like the old drunk lady that comes into the bar trying to sell silk roses at 12:30. You know, where you just want to kill yourself. You just feel bad for everybody involved. It was like that with a dash of that like job for a day place, you know, where it's like you just stand outside and the guy comes out and goes, okay, who knows anything about caulking? Okay. And grouting? Tree stump removal. And it's like, you know, you're just sitting there hoping that they'll hire you for like that one afternoon. Because it was just a bunch of guys standing around. And so what they just took like 25 or 30 guys, and they had 10 guys who worked there, and they would take like three or four guys at a time, stick them with one of the 10 guys who worked there. And then basically you would all just like pile into this guy's El Camino or whatever. And then he would basically just start as he would get onto the highway, he would start this little spiel about you were just doing this, basically. He would then just load you with a box of crap. Like, what is this? Well, it's Lyle the Crocodile children's books. And he would just drop you off at like a block in some, you know, residential neighborhood and be like, okay, I'll be back in 90 minutes. Sell all of those or you got to walk. You know, and that was it. And I think – and I got about – I think I got about like 5 minutes into trying to sell the first one of those. And it was just one of those like I would rather starve. Like I would rather cut off my own feet and boil them. I don't care. I can't do this. And I really in a strange way admire – anybody who can do that, because that's a thing that I was wholly incapable of that kind of gig. So, all right. So apparently, though I didn't examine the thriving diaper selling business at the Windsor Cove.
No, you need to see. Think of all the money you could have made reselling stolen diapers.
I was just throwing it away, Don. Let's see. We've got a telephone call. I believe let's see. Andy. Andy, the formerly homeschooled man. Hello, Andy. You're on the Rick Emerson radio program. How can I help ye?
I just had a quick relation to the diaper swiper people.
Are you calling from a classroom film in 1978?
No, I'm calling from Skype.
Okay. All right.
My computer just has this really bad built-in mic, so I have no idea how quality it is.
Okay, well, that's I'll try to keep my responses brief. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Start at the top, sir.
I just wanted to share an observation. I was on the Max yesterday, and this guy comes down the Max talking to each person, and all he says is, $30 wallet, $5.
That's fantastic, especially because it doesn't like I mean, I guess that's a thing that is so dumb and simple and brilliant all at the same time in its brevity. Excellent. Were people taken in by this?
No, okay. Not at all. Guess he even tried to sell the case that the wallet was in. Like, you know what makes a good bedside good thing to put on your bedside table? Put some jewelry in it, your watch.
Was he ascribing a dollar value to the box that the $30, nay $5 wallet had come in?
No, he was. I think he was doing like his own version of the. And if you call in now, you'll get this free gift.
But the gift was just like a cardboard box in which had been this item that he was trying to pawn off on people.
I mean, it did open and close. Like, it had that thing where it
looked
like
it did open and close. It wasn't entirely without value, Rick. It did function as advertised. I must give the gentleman that. Okay. Andy, you've made our day a little bit brighter.
There was no way anybody was going to buy that because either it's not worth $30 or it's stolen or both.
Okay. Excellent.
They just weren't in the market for a wallet at that time.
That's true.
This is what I miss about riding the Max every day like
wow.
I used to.
God damn. All right. Thank you, my friend. That was really truly a fantastic call. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. There you go. All right. That's Andy. All right. Jesus, God. Well, let's just do one more. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the EH vending clue for today. We got the top five coming up. Did you say the Rodney Crowell piece was yesterday?
Yesterday.
What is coming up in the Oregonian? What is on your horizon?
Oh, we got a little bits and pieces of this and that.
You don't know.
I got no idea.
It opens, it closes.
I got no idea. We got some stuff. I got to start cramming for Jazz Fest at the end of February. It takes a month for me to get ready for Jazz Fest because I don't know anything about jazz.
I was just going to say, I hate to put you on the spot here because I know you're speaking as a representative of the Oregonian. How do you feel about jazz in general and much less having to cover Jazz Fest?
You know what? I saw some really good shows last year, and I give Bill Royston, who programs the festival, a lot of credit for creating interesting story angles for me to write about. This year, it's the coming together of African American musicians and Jewish jazz musicians. Okay.
When they say so, Jazz Fest, which is a thing I think I've successfully avoided it for however long it's been around. I mean, this is not. I mean, it's been. Does it happen every year? Or?
Yeah, this is kind of. I think they would consider it at least the second iteration of the PDX Jazz and the PDX Jazz Festival. And you know, they've got Esperanza Spalding coming in. They made her the. She's from here. She's having a huge year.
I have no idea.
Grammy nominations, and so she's bass player, singer from of the jazz persuasion. Lives in New York now, but she's kind of the community outreach person for it. And they got her coming back, and you know, they've got some really cool stuff. And I saw some really interesting things last year, but I don't know anything about it. Like I had this conversation with Bill and Don Lukoff, kind of the two top people with PDX Jazz now. Last year, I said, you know. I know Kind of Blue is a great jazz album because right. You know Kind of Blue is a great jazz album.
Right.
Like, even if you don't know anything about jazz, you know it's considered by everybody to be one of those things. And I love listening to that record on like a Sunday morning. But if you're asking me to sit down and listen to two jazz records and say, well, this one's doing – I just don't know. So it takes me a – writing about jazz is hard for me. It takes a lot of reporting. It can't be like me firing off –
jazz,
thoughts on it.
It's one of those things where, like, for me, it's sort of like – it's like flying on instruments, you know? You can't see the ground. You don't really have any idea how to land the plane in, like, a gut sort of an instant because you don't know where you are. You have no landmarks. There is nothing there that you recognize. And so you just have to look at the dial and the gauge, and you have to trust that what you are reading and what the dial is telling you is correct because you can't tell. And that's how I am with jazz.
Done well live, it's a lot of fun to watch because you can, you know, as you watch the instruments kind of work against each other and kind of find their own space within songs and stuff, it's pretty cool. But, you know, I got a CD today that, you know, was self-identified as a smooth jazz CD, but it was called Love and Sax. And my only thought was, really, where it took until 2011 for somebody to title a smooth jazz CD Love and Sax? I can't believe that it took till 2011 for somebody to do that.
And I know that this is true of every form of music, but it's like, I feel like the tiny, tiny percentage of jazz music that I might find tolerable or good is just, it's like just a wash in just this Exxon Valdez size spill of just crap that I don't care about. And stuff that is, again, because the other thing is, and I know that rock has this problem as well, but when people say jazz, like, I have no idea what that means. Like, I don't know if that's Benny Goodman or if it's Miles Davis or if it's, you'll hear somebody say, well, you know, jazz musicians like your John Lee Hooker. And it's like, and I have no idea if that's even, or if they're just saying it to like, if they're bluffing just to see if I buy it.
My kind of jazz, like Tuesday night, a week from tomorrow, is that right? Yeah, Dante's on the 8th. Trombone Shorty's coming to town. 24 years old now, just this phenom, trombone player, trumpet player. First time I saw him was in New Orleans, and he brought Wynton Marsalis out on stage, and they had like a 20-minute trumpet duel. That's my kind of jazz because there's also this rock funk band behind him, and they just throw down in this great live show. I mean, it's going to be amazing. And then the next night, Social Distortions. It's like going to be the two best nights possibly all year.
People who are really into jazz, I always feel like, you know, it's like I always feel like when I'm talking to jazz people or like people who are, you know, or like, you know, like sometimes I'll be like looking something up on the net and I'll stumble onto, as I did actually last night while putting together today's top five, like I stumbled onto some sort of a prog rock message board, and it was like, and I just don't belong there. Like those are, you know, they don't want me, I don't want them, and it's like, it's you know, it's like you're walking to the wrong club, and you go, ooh, not for me, and you gotta leave.
I wrote this last year when I was writing the, you know, the first Jazz Fest any cover story that I had to write. Jazz people are like surfers, and that they speak, you know, they speak about jazz in the same way that surfers speak about the earth in ways that sound really cool when you're
right.
Sitting there listening to it, but you can't. Like, you know, I don't have the connection to the ocean the way somebody who surfs in it does. I just think it's pretty to look at and have a beer next to.
I also feel about jazz the way I feel about a lot of, like abstract art or sort of, you know, surrealist art. I feel like it's about 10% content and the rest of it is like an elaborate goof that they're pulling on the rest of us. Go,
yeah.
Like, look at these fools. They're going to pay $10,000 for this thing. It's just a pile of newspapers.
I listen to jazz at home mostly as sort of background music when I'm working because I can't listen to anything. When I'm writing, I can't listen to anything that's lyrics because it just completely – so I'll listen to either, like, movie soundtrack music or jazz. And almost everything I listen to is sort of very classic horn-based kind of stuff. Miles Davis, Stan right. Getz, that kind of thing. But I've just recently learned when I'm listening to using the Pandora stations on my iPhone, I can't listen to that when I'm driving because it either – like mellows me to the point where I like lose my concentration and can't pay attention to the driving because I just sort of start to kind of zone out, or it gives me this feeling of impending doom, like I'm in some kind of like a gangster movie and I'm about to drive underneath a bridge somewhere where someone's going to shoot me.
I my thing is there's that, there's the like, because I have you know, I have you mentioned Kind of Blue. I have that with a friend, actually got that for me because he was so tired of me saying that I'd never heard any jazz that I liked and that it was all, you know, and I used to be much more. I've actually mellowed out a lot in terms of my music taste. I used to be really, really, really strident about my music taste and about the music taste of others. And I used to be very, very like unforgiving and inflexible. And I had that kind of what is that? Jimmy Rabbit in The Commitments when he's, you know, and he says jazz is musical wanking, and he just sort of stomps out of the room. And like that was my thing. I was like, you know, that was how I, because I think I just never heard anything that appealed to me. So it's actually around the same time that a guy gave me the Imperial Bedroom because he was tired of me saying that I'd never heard any Elvis Costello that I could really get into. So he got me Kind of Blue, which is great. But it's like. But I can also tell, and it's not, I've reached the point where it's like, I no longer really care what anybody thinks of my music taste. So I would, if I heard something that was jazzy that I liked, I would admit it. But I can just tell it's not for me. And it's just because the way I can tell it's not for me is because now that I've got Kind of Blue, which I do love, which is a great record, I immediately have a place of like, well, now I'm set. That's fantastic. I am good. Good to go. And when I hear
one shelf that just says jazz, yeah. And that's the only CD that's on it.
And I should, you know, and it, you know, I'll listen to it and it's great, but it's like I have no desire once it's done to listen to more. And it, and plus the thing is all jazz kind of sounds the same to me. And so it's almost like I've got a million jazz records because, you know, I just can't tell one song from another. The other thing about jazz is I do have a little bit of that. I get some of that like weird like class/culture issue thing going on where it's like I feel like it's like a train full of people reading the New Yorker and like you're there with your copy of like, you know, Club, you know, you're there behind your Hustler, you're behind your Mickey Spillane novel and just feeling uneducated. And jazz really does make me feel like a rube sometimes when I listen to it.
No, there are, you know, there's certainly a segment of the jazz population that is very strident, very hardcore on what their definition of jazz is. And one, the thing that I wrote about last year was Bill Royston tried really hard to kind of approach that and blow it up by theming the festival around a book that was written a few years ago called Is Jazz Dead or Has It Moved to a New Address, in that address being Norway, where they're doing all, you know, where you've got government funding for artists and all these things, and they're doing this really avant-garde stuff. He brought a couple of Norwegian acts over. There's this band called, excuse me, In the Country that played over at Norse Hall that was just great. Now, I don't really like the record that much. It doesn't have near the kind of the swells and the emotion that their live show had, but they were just awesome. They told this hilarious story about being allowed to play like ABBA's piano when they were in the studio to record this one song. And it was like the greatest thing that had ever happened to them, and stuff like that. But you know, a lot of the stuff that is here is stuck in this very strange. This is jazz. Jazz is defined this way by these beats and these things. And if you're outside of that, it's not jazz, and we don't want to hear you.
It's strange that jazz and punk are actually the two music forms that seem to cling most tenaciously to their ideology. Yeah. They're very, as you said, they're very sort of stringent about what does and what does not. Well, and we're getting into the whole thing. There's no time. So forth. Let's do, speaking of music, let's do the snuff watch. We'll get that done. Okay. We got to take a break because we got to talk about some other stuff. We got to come back. We got the EH vending clue number one for this week's Name That Snack. Then coming up, we got the top five non-comprehensible hit songs, the top five unintelligible hit songs. Here is Dawn Taylor.
Snuff watch.
Here's your snuff watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Dawn Taylor with your snuff watch.
Five-time Oscar-winning composer John Barry, who wrote music for a dozen James Bond films, has died. He was 77. Barry died in New York, where he had lived for some time. On Sunday, his family said, the family did not release the cause of death. Though his work on the Bond films is among his most famous, the composer wrote a long list of scores, including Midnight Cowboy, Dances with Wolves, and Body Heat. He was proud of writing both for big action blockbusters and smaller films. He won two Oscars for Born Free in 1966, Best Score and Best Song. He also earned Oscars for the scores to The Lion in Winter, Out of Africa, and Dances with Wolves. His association with Bond began with Dr. No in 1962, although his contribution to that film was not credited and remains in dispute. Monty Norman, who was credited as the composer for Dr. No, sued the Sunday Times in 2001 for reporting that Barry had composed the theme, working from scraps of Norman's work.
Now, wait a minute. Are we talking about the classic Bond theme?
Mm-hmm.
The da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the thing we're talking about.
Yeah.
So this is – there was a dispute about it.
Yeah. John Barry testified he was paid £250 to work on the theme music, developing the guitar line from part of Monty Norman's song Bad Sign, Good Sign. But he did agree that Norman would get the credit. He was asked whether Norman wrote the theme, and he responded, absolutely not. In later years, Barry limited his comment on the case to saying, if I didn't write it, why did they keep asking me to do the other ones?
Well, that's a fair point, I suppose. Wow. Okay.
Because he subsequently wrote music for Goldfinger, From Russia with Love, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Diamonds Are Forever, The Man with the Golden Gun, Moonraker, Octopussy, A View to a Kill, and The Living Daylights.
Okay.
Yeah. He also scored Robin and Marian, Somewhere in Time, The Cotton Club, Peggy Sue Got Married, and Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
He was nominated for Oscars for his scores for Mary Queen of Scots in 71 and Chaplin in 1992. He trained as a pianist, studied counterpoint with York Cathedral organist Francis Jackson, and later took up the trumpet. He founded a jazz group, the John Barry Seven, in 1957. And in an interview in 2008, he said his success was not that difficult. He said, if you hit the right formula, if you have an instinct for music, if you apply it, if you have the good fortune to meet with certain people who teach you well, I didn't find it all that difficult.
You know, guys who are geniuses just, you know, they always think it's like with a wave of their hand.
If seven things go exactly right for you, it'll be easy.
Yeah.
Like me.
If you're brilliant and people like give you a shot and pay you to do it, it's a piece of cake.
Did you ever see video of when Tim Robbins was at Sundance for Dead Man Walking, and there was a guy that they kept asking Howard the Duck questions?
No.
Oh, it was so great. It was great.
He doesn't ever even put that like on his resume. Never ever mentions that movie.
No. Howard. Nobody puts Howard the Duck on their resume. It's like Dylan and Self Portrait. They just pretend it doesn't exist. It's just it never came out. I know what you're talking about. But and even better, and I won't say he was a friend of mine, but I didn't know that guy. He was a film critic in Salt Lake, and it was I think it was for Dead Man Walking. And he was, and they're like, are there any questions for the filmmakers? And immediately, this guy's like, I have a question about Howard the Duck. And it was, Robin, it was just immediately like his face just into this iron mask of hate. It was so great. It was just one of the best moments ever, especially because I didn't have to to be there or see it firsthand or anything, or just be there, be around for the beating of this guy savagely by what I would imagine was a large army of goons acting at Tim Robbins' behest. So to do the music for Howard the Duck and James Bond, that's probably healthy because you have both ends of the. Do you ever notice how much the Star Wars theme sounds like Born Free? Born Free, na 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 na. I think that Born Free, the first, whatever, 16 bars or something, sounds astonishingly similar to the Star Wars theme.
Well, John, at the risk of incurring geek wrath, John Williams is not the most innovative of composers.
Well, he does a few things, and he has a few moving parts, and he rearranges them interestingly.
He's very good at pulling things from other sources
inspired
and rearranging them.
Homages, no.
Yes.
That's what he does.
And then he's very good at reworking things he had written previously into other things as well.
If you can get paid and get a fistful of Oscars and, Grammys, whatever, doing that, hey, have at it. John Williams is, who am I to criticize, but John Williams is a master of, he is sort of the big melody theory in that, you just need, and I mean this as a compliment, music doesn't have to be all that complex. What he has done is he took the pop formula and applied it to classical in that, mm-hmm. You just need the one big hook. If you got the one melodic hook or the one little line, the one little guitar riff that people remember and they go, oh, that riff is awesome. You can get away with the rest of the song can be decent or mediocre, sometimes not even that. You got the one riff,
Williams' genius was in taking taking hooks and snatches and really well-crafted pieces of other people's classical music and then just sort of refiguring them into movie scores. And he did the same thing with jazz, talking about jazz, for his score for Catch Me If You Can is really terrific. And it sounds very different from most of his other scores because he was deliberately doing sort of a jazzy thing. But you can hear all of, let's call them influences,
right,
where he got all of the stuff that he cobbled together for that score.
Well, there is some piece of classical music, and I'm not knowledgeable enough about classic to conjure it up from my memory, but there is some piece of classical music, and there's some... There's like a URL that went around the net a few years ago. Like there was that thing that went around the net a couple years back called like Dane Cook as a joke stealing mother effer, and it was just like him and like Louis C.K. edited back to back, so you could hear like the word for word ripoff. And there was a thing where it was like the Star Wars theme, and then it was some classical piece of music, and it was very very similar, you know. But again, it's like there's nothing original, and you, as Paul Stanley says, just make sure you're stealing diamonds, not glass. We'll just end it on Paul Stanley, as we always do. There you go. There's your snuff watch. By the way, this is why jazz people don't take me seriously, because I end arguments by referencing Paul Stanley. So that's it. That's why I'm never. Were you having R2 and Leia dance?
Yes, they were dancing to Jim Carroll.
Have you seen any of those recent interviews with Carrie Fisher? I don't mean this in a bad way. Boy, what a great sort of like mouthy dame she's become. You know, as she's gotten older, where she clearly is just like doesn't care, which is sort of great. I mean, she has become she's actually gotten better and more interesting and more entertaining as she has gotten older.
Well, she fascinates me too because again, she's in her 50s.
Yeah.
And she has a blog, which she only, updates. Until recently, she's only updated it sporadically. And she's been going around doing her one-woman show based on the most recent book she did. But the thing is, a lot of her interviews and the stuff she's been talking about is this kind of, oh, yeah, people have been noticing that I'm in my 50s and I got fat. Yeah. Oh, excuse me all to hell for not right. always looking like I was 23 in a metal bikini. But the thing is now she's signed on as a spokesperson for Jenny Craig. So now she's updating her blog like every day or something, talking about her weight loss. And she's still kind of trying to maintain the same mouthy dame kind of take me as I am, rah, right. kind of thing. But at the same time, she's now contractually obligated to
lose weight and
and to talk about like these terrific Jenny dinners that I'm bringing home and use. And
I'm filled with self-loathing.
And it's just like, it's so kind of sad, but at the same time, it's also kind of awesome that she's like attempting to kind of, fulfill her obligations to them while maintaining her own integrity.
I heard an interview with...
It's a dance.
It's that whole thing where like when Kirstie Alley was on Jenny Craig and they said like one of the worst jobs in all the world where they were like were the people who had to go to Kirstie Alley's house and to like, and to sort of weigh her every week and to make sure that she was, she was losing weight. And it's like they said you would get there and it was like you could just you could tell somebody said you could tell that a giant plate of nachos had just moments before been created and consumed, sort of like as a last ditch before they arrived. And it's like, we can't tell why she's not losing weight. And that's got to be because it's like you have to lose the weight or they just boot you off the gig.
Yeah. Well, what happened about like 8 months ago or something? Jason Alexander was announced as he was doing something for Weight Watchers
really?
Or something like that. And I think he did one commercial and then it just disappeared.
Gone.
It was just gone. And I'm like, what happened? It wasn't working. He just wouldn't do it. He just didn't like it.
He got a week into it and it was like, F this.
Yeah, he just got into a plate of brownies and just said, ah, screw you.
It's not
the
worth
money
it.
That
I'm
badly.
Rich. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, it was like, boom, it was gone.
What is that new, the new Carrie Fisher book and show called? It's like a pun. It's
Wishful Drinking.
Wishful Drinking is what it is. And it's one of those things, again, where this is sort of great and terrible, where you look at the cover of the book and I think the poster for the show, because I think it was playing in New York last time I was there, where it's sort of pandering and manipulative and sad and great all at once, where it's just somewhat presumably her. As Princess Leia with the white robe and the little pin curl, the little the pinwheel hair things, but then just like face down on the table with like bottles everywhere and like cigarettes and, you know, like asleep in her own sick, as they used to say, which is sort of great, you know. And it's on the one hand, you go like, she's still just ringing that bell. But on the other hand, like, why not? You know, I mean, it is kind of her life. It is sort of a unique and very glittery prison to be in, being Princess Leia. I know there are far worse fates, but that is got to be a particular kind of stress, you know, in a way that being, you know, like in a way that being Luke Skywalker probably was not.
Yes.
So in any event. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. I was going to take a break, but if y'all unless anyone has to use the lavatory. Ryan White, why don't you, if you want to do that, I'll take a moment to talk about our good friends at Squires Electric.
Okay.
Squires Electric can be found out more about, or something like that, at squireselectric.com. That is squireselectric.com. You can call 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. We had Joe Squires here on Friday. If you are listening live, or you're not quite caught up, you're listening to this show, somebody you haven't heard last Friday, you got to check out last Friday's show. It was it was quite great. It was the 28th. He talked about a lot of things that we've just been meaning to get to forever. Like, first of all, did you have any idea that on a submarine that they, quote, made their own air?
I didn't realize that until he was talking to us. Now I didn't know that.
I didn't know it was possible. I mean,
it makes sense. Theirs got to come from somewhere.
I guess. I thought that they had, like, big... I'm such an idiot. I thought they just had, like, big tanks of it or something. But that's stupid. Mm. Because I thought that they had big tanks of air, and then occasionally they would go up to the surface and refill them from, you know, the sky. Which is just dumb. You say it out loud, and it's like, well, what... How would they even do that? You know, like a vacuum or something? And then they just, like, quick, cork it up.
I think I probably thought that they just, like, kept circulating the old air and threw something and adding something to it from a tank. Like, they had tanks of oxygen, and then people would breathe all the oxygen out, and then they'd add more back. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know why that happened. And when he was telling us they made their own air, I thought... Oh, I guess that makes sense.
I guess sure. I could have figured out the thing that they're taking seawater and making it drinkable, but the making their own air thing.
Yeah.
If you ever really wanted, like, an object, this is like the Bond composing guy. If you ever wanted an object lesson in how nature parcels out intelligence and the ability to learn and process and understand certain things, you need look no further. Than Joe Squires. So that's really what I'm telling you. They've been here in Portland for over a decade, and going on 13 years, Squires Electric has been there. Electrical wiring of any kind in your home or business. So if you want to do it yourself, here's what I would suggest. If you're going to really be installing your own electrical system at home, first of all, don't. But if you're going to disregard that advice, I would say it's like when you start some new dermatological product or you're painting. They say, start in a very small area just to see what the reaction is. So don't decide that, like, if you're going to build your family a dream house, and you will go in and you will wrestle the great god Electros to the ground, and you will wire things yourself as a man should. Because then it's just going to, like, jump cut to the family, like, sort of, you know, gathered around and sobbing, and then your wife checking out, like, personals ads. So you don't want to do that. You want to have it done by somebody who knows what they're doing. 503-252-1609. That's how you contact Squires Electric. Or if you are a business, you're moving into a new facility, or if you're working a restaurant someplace where the city's going to come through, they're going to do an inspection. You got to make sure you pass, because if you fail, then it's like then it's that thing where they put an F or something in the window of your store, and then or whatever. It's like where they infested by louse or something. Like a restaurant.
I don't think the Squires Electric can help you with your
with your louse problem.
Your lice.
Hey, is louse, is that like singular for lice?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Delousing is like delicing.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't be infected by louse and thought it was huge or had a gun or something.
Right.
Okay. Hey, do they do that in restaurants you worked in, culinary stuff? Like, do they put, like, a letter grade in the window if you fail the health inspection?
I think that's a state-to-state thing. I think in some states they do. I don't think I've ever seen it on the West Coast. Not since I was a kid. I remember seeing some places in Long Beach, California, that had the failed by the health department thing stuck in the front window, and I remember asking my mother what that meant. But I don't know. I think that may be up to individual health departments in different states or different counties or something.
Ryan White, you looked as though you were going to speak there.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't know anything about health codes.
All right then. I don't even know.
I know less about health codes than I know about jazz.
Here in Portland, they just report you to the dirty dining people on Channel 12 or whatever.
Joe Donlan or somebody comes out and waves a microphone at you.
Some woman comes and
says, what are these droppings?
Nowadays, they just tweet it.
Yeah. Well, in any event, you want to pass the inspection the first time when it comes to electrical, when it comes to all things electrical, the wiring in your business. And if it's your home, you want to get it done correctly. 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. It's 503-252-1609. And, of course, they're not just a business partner. They are, in fact, longtime listeners to the show as well. So do tell me you heard it here, if you would. That is 503-252-1609. That is Squires Electric, ladies and gentlemen.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We're here with Mr. Ryan White, music editor from The Oregonian. You can read him, of course, in print in The Oregonian or online at oregonlive.com/music.
Correct.
Excellent. Fantastic. In just a moment, we'll do the top five. By the way, this is how timely Rick Emerson is.
Look at
you
that.
You mentioned the Bond guy dead. I find the Bond theme.
The Bond guy.
There you go. Yes. The Bond guy. Well, it's a big world. There's a lot of information. I had to remember the name of the power droid in IG-88.
Do you want to go engage in a car chase?
I'm sorry?
This makes me want to go engage in a car chase.
Did we ever do... we've never done this top five. We have done top five songs. Top five songs that would accompany an action sequence if your own life were a movie. So I did that. It was like top five songs that if your life were an action movie that would be playing. And I had like Monkey Man and whatever. You know what we've never done? And I don't think actually you guys have done that. I think that was only a thing I did because it was such a dumb idea that nobody else ever wanted
to do.
You
had me do a top five songs that would accompany...
Your opening credits in the movie of your life.
Opening credits, yes.
If they told the movie of your life, the Don Taylor story, what would the opening theme be? What we should do is top five songs that will result in rapid acceleration if you were driving. Top five songs that make you speed. We could do that.
Okay.
Because this, as you said, this is one of those songs where you hear a certain song in the radio, and the next thing you know, you're going 80 miles an hour or something. There's something to be said for that. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. In just one moment, we'll roll today's top five. The top five most unintelligible hits. These are, by the way, I can either print this out or there's in the Dropbox, there's a little text folder that's got that. The top five most unintelligible hit songs. In just one moment, we will reveal the first clue for this week's Name That Snack contest. We should say, by the way, that last week's winner is Eric Vandervoort. Eric Vandervoort, who identified last week's snack as being pirate booty. So that is last week. So, of course, what we're going to do this week is we'll give you one clue every day. Once Friday comes around, you're shaking your head sadly.
There is no top five.
It's just not there. What is it? What is up with that?
I don't know. You put things in the Dropbox. You say, and then they don't show up. I put things in, and you get them.
Is it like where your computer has developed some sort of a dislike for my computer, or there's some sort of a? Has this just become sort of a?
Maybe
like a
you're
willful,
just doing it wrong.
Just some sort of a willful myopia on the part of your machine. Of course, that chair over there is cursed anyway, because isn't that the place where like your computer and Eric Snyder's computer both just quit seeing the Wi-Fi?
Yeah,
like you sat down and suddenly it was like you were just in some weird dome of silence. Did you ever do this? Do you ever just walking around and it's like you know, like you're on your phone or whatever, and like I'll notice that my iPhone has switched over to Wi-Fi from cell phone. Like if I'm, you know, be like just around in public or at a restaurant or something, and then you think, well, that's weird. I didn't know I was in a Wi-Fi zone. And then you start to think, well, wait a minute. This phone receives, you know, calls no matter where I am in the world. You know, basically, I can go walk right within reason, pretty much anywhere. And you think, well, so can everybody else's. And then you just have this moment of like horror where the camera pulls back to like viewing us from the edge of the Milky Way. And you realize that your body is being hit by electrical waves of one form or another like a billion times a second. Every single square inch of your body is being hit by transmission waves and microwaves and sound waves and cell phone signals literally like all the time at every single moment. Just think about that tonight when you try to sleep in what Nietzsche called the wolf hour. Just don't let it bother you, though.
Rick makes me weep at night.
Sorry. Well, you've got – well, you know, ear infections are clearly going to take you down first, so.
I weep about a lot of things lately.
Would you say that you – I guess we could tell the story. Not having asked for permission, I do it anyway. So you got a haircut today?
I did.
Did you say that you just went in and the woman's like, what do you want with your hair? And you're like, you basically in your head thought, I'm married, I got a kid, I don't know, just do whatever.
I don't care, and I feel so bad for these, like, I get my hair cut like 4 times a year, and the nice woman is like, well, what do you want done? I'm like, shorter.
That's it, just this,
like,
but
well,
less.
Do you want this, or what? I don't know, just shorter, I don't really care. I'm not going to complain, whatever you do, it'll, to this point, it's always grown back.
And they must get that, where guys just go and they go, I want exactly what I have now, but smaller.
She actually said I did better than some people do.
Really?
No.
I actually went through a phase where I carried a picture of me. I got a particularly great haircut. And I immediately had, like, photos taken from, like, 3 different angles. I guess I could do that with my iPhone now. And then I went in, I'm like, this. Make it this again. Do this.
Yeah, I just don't care.
Did you ever go through a phase where you styled your hair a lot or you took a lot of time with your hair?
No, I never have. For a long time, you know, into my late 20s, I kept it really short all the time. And then there was a girlfriend who talked me into just letting it grow. And I realized that getting my hair cut 4 times a year is kind of awesome. But there's a point where it gets too long in the front, and I can't see anything. And then it starts to kind of curl up, and I get these, like, kind of Sally Field flying nun wings out the back of them. And it's almost mullified. It works when I'm playing hockey, because I get, like, this great hockey hair out the back. But but then, you know, on the front, like, Friday night I was trying to play, and I had hair coming down in my eyes, and I'm challenged enough to see as it is.
I think if you had long hair, you would look like Kenny Loggins to an almost astonishing degree. I'm just saying.
I walked by Anna Griffin. We passed each other in the street this morning. She goes, you look like an album cover. I said, is the album called Lazy?
It is time for this week's first clue for the E.H. Benning's Name That Snack contest. Again, we'll give away a heaping helping of items that you might find inside one of the vending machines from E.H. Benning. We'll do that this Friday. If you were the first person to correctly identify once this Friday comes around and we've given out that today's clue, the snack about which we are speaking, you do that via snack at rickemerson.com. Just like it sounds, rickemerson.com, snack at rickemerson.com. We should say, by the way, that this contest is brought to you by EH Vending, and you can find them at ehvending.com, or you can call Josh at 360-816-1853. If you are the decision maker, if you're the person who owns the business, you are the manager of the business, and you find that your employees, basically, if you want to quell some sort of Egypt-style uprising right now, you want to stop it in its tracks, here's what you do. You just keep them doped up on sugar and carbs all the time, and then you can break their will more easily.
Are you suggesting Mubarak's problem was not enough Funyuns?
That's what I'm saying. You know, here's the thing. You give people too much protein, they get antsy, and then they start thinking for themselves. The key is you just give them a lot of, like, Mike and Ike's, you know, or just like those grandma, like those carnival, or the animal crackers with the pink and the white frosting, and then just have them, you know, I don't know, just have them go, you know, get your dirt out of their ditch or whatever it is, you know, over and over again.
Crackers are good.
Exactly.
Yeah. You get one of those machines, you get some coffee, you know.
Yeah.
They don't ever have to leave, and they'll be very productive.
And they can be part of the glorious workers' revolution, Don.
Yeah.
That took a dark turn. Anyway, you can contact them if you like it. We're not suggesting that you don't beat your employees. You know, or what? You didn't hear from
or
me
do.
At least. Or, you know, I mean, yeah, just leave me out of it.
Don't turn off your country's internet and like, you shoot your employees.
Just don't mention my name. That's all. You know, it's like, it's none of my concern, as they say. You can also contact James,
have
the sales manager, 503-897-8204. And they have everything from traditional soda and snack machines to the office coffee supply to the big glass panel fridges. So if you don't have a vending machine, this could be why your employees hate you, frankly. I mean, this could be it. You might not offend in any sort of hygienic way. You might be a nice guy, you know, but all work and no snacks, you know, makes Jack an angry employee. So don't be that boss. You contact EH Vending and I guarantee you they'll find something that works well with your budget, and they are longtime listeners and friends of the show. So do contact them at ehvending.com. Here is the first clue for this week. This is your first clue. Today's clue is savory. There you go. It's the first clue. Savory. Excellent. On that note, here is your top five for Monday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
You know, Ryan White is just creating a little diorama with Star Wars figures.
Counting is wonderful.
Ryan White, predictions for the big game this Sunday?
Pittsburgh? I don't care.
Sorry, I didn't mean to take you away from...
Come on, he's trying to set up... Leah's talking to the droids, and...
I just... I
C-3PO
I hope
is
it's a good
giving
game.
A Nazi salute.
Okay.
I just hope it's a good game. I like, you know,
it's always a blowout, though, isn't it? I mean, the Super Bowl, or is that an urban legend?
There have been a couple good ones in the last few years. So, you know, it's one of those things you get, you know, we'll get together with our friends that we always get together with, and we'll get a bunch of food, and, you know, half of us will get really drunk, and the other half will have to watch all the kids and drive the drunk ones home. And I just hope it's an entertaining game. Either way, we'll sit there and make fun of everything, and you won't be able to differentiate the Black Eyed Peas commercials from the Black Eyed Peas halftime show. And,
The end.
The end.
This is your top five for Monday. These are the top five most unintelligible hit songs. Don Taylor.
Honorable mention, Jim Ellis, the closing theme to WKRP in Cincinnati.
Honorable mention, because it's not really unlike the theme song. It wasn't released as a single in its own right, but everybody does know this. And it's also an honorable mention. Does anybody know why? Anyone?
Because you already did it as a pop culture authority that one time?
Well, not only that, but what did I reveal in that pop culture authority?
That it doesn't have any actual
words.
There
are, in fact, no lyrics. It is not unintelligible. There are, in fact, no words to this. So this is which is sort of great, though. I mean, you got to give it up for the fact that, like, for 30 years, we all tried to figure it out. It's kind of amazing that it took that long. And I think the guy himself, Jim Ellis, actually had to admit at one point, he's like, it was the scratch track. There we go. that it was just a demo, and they went, oh, it's fine. And he goes, no, it's just a demo. And they're like, no, it's good, thanks. And that was it. And it's, I think if he hadn't actually clarified it, we'd still be trying to figure it out. It was like some sort of gag magic eye poster where there really was no image anywhere. These are the top five unintelligible hit songs of all time, Don Taylor.
Number five, The Kingsman, Louie Louie.
Of course. This seems improbable, but it's true. There's a fantastic book about this song. It is by Dave Marsh, just called Louie Louie, and it is about the history of and life of this song. Everything from when Richard Berry first played it, and I think he's the guy who sort of brought it. It was maybe a traditional Jamaican song, I think, the way I heard it, and he sort of brought it and made it into a pop song. And then it became like a game of telephone. I think it was somebody said they heard it playing through a wall. They heard a band playing it on the other side of a wall, and so it was muffled, and so they left one of the... they left part of the chords out, or one of the beats out, which is, I think, why the Beach Boys version is different. It has that weird staccato rhythm to it. You probably know way more about this than I do. But
I don't know, there's a fantastic Todd Snyder song about this song called "The Ballad of the Kingsman."
Really,
which gets into you know, the way music's been blamed for a great many things over the years. But it the basis of it is this, where, you know, there's a lyric. Now I don't know the lyrics to "Louie Louie," and I'm pretty sure the singer for the Kingsman didn't know them either. If he did, they came out jumbled in his mouth. Like, you know, sings me, me go, oh, so constantly, amea, meka, ah, ooh, ah. And then it goes into Marilyn Manson and rap, and it's a really, really great kind of folk rap piece.
I've never actually been to the place downtown. I know that downtown somewhere is the location of the studio where they recorded this. I forget where it actually is. I don't think the studio's there anymore, but it's like on the corner of 5th and whatever. And, of course, the thing about this song is that there was one mic, there was a ceiling mic. Any guy had to strain to reach it. I forget the singer's name, but he couldn't quite reach the mic. He was on his tiptoes, and he had braces, and only had like a passing knowledge of the song's lyrics. Plus, they didn't have time to rehearse it because they were in a race with Paul Revere and the Raiders to get it recorded, because they had both heard the song and they had played it at competing high school dances, and the kids like went nuts, and they're like, "We gotta get this recorded," and so they raced into the studio, and it was like a rush to see who could get it out first.
And from all that, an FBI file.
The fact that that's not an urban legend, that the goddamn FBI spent time and money investigating this song. So I strongly recommend the book Louie Louie by Dave Marsh. I will say, by the way, this is simultaneously, just like somebody said Johnny Ramone was the best and worst guitar player on earth at the same moment, this is simultaneously one of the best and worst recorded songs, one of the best and worst performed songs ever to exist. I mean, it's so bad. It's so fundamentally terrible in its execution, but but for an intangible reason, it becomes wonderful.
And then you put it in Animal House, and nothing makes college males drink quite as hard, and then like hug each other like this song.
Wow, way to hit the post. Top five unintelligible pop songs, hit songs. Don Taylor.
Number four, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, Woolly Bully.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
I saw Warren Zevon play this one time.
Really?
Yes, at the Aladdin. He seemed totally amused by himself for deciding to play Woolly Bully.
Now, some of these songs, I think, over the years, people have learned the lyrics, like in the case of Louie Louie, because it was so notorious. And maybe, in, you know, with certain other things, it's like the advent of the internet has made it possible to, you know, go on and figure it out. But I have no idea. Horns?
Yeah.
Yeah, had two big horns and a woolly dog.
I see, I heard...
I thought Woolly Jaw.
I thought Woolly Jaw, too. See, now we're just becoming the Kiss... Excuse me, what, like Kiss a Walnut guy or whatever that guy is. Take no chance? Excellent. Next, not be a scrubber. Dance. Learn to dance,
Come
I got
learn
that.
Learn to dance, yeah.
Rock is stupid and great.
I do know this is about someone named Maddie talking to someone named Patty.
So clearly this is like before a cotillion.
It's no wonder Steve Allen just listened to this and was just, these kids. Dreck. Whatever happened to Mersey Doats? These are the top five unintelligible hit songs of all time. Dawn Taylor?
Number three, Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit.
And this is one that I think probably everybody, they know at least part of these lyrics. If for no other reason, then they finally just went online and were like, what are the goddamn lyrics? And I guess, and I think they're in, I think these are actually the only lyrics printed in the liner notes to the original version of Nevermind, but I could be wrong about that. But it's written like Paul's Boutique, where it's all just one big paragraph. Famously parodied, of course, by Weird Al in Smells Like Nirvana. I'm just picturing Weird Al doing the thing where he's like spitting marbles out of his mouth and he's like Argle Blargle Nos or whatever on the subtitles.
Just reminds me that as well as you think you know this song, you really don't know this song.
No. It also reminds you, by the way, that great song though it is, and it really is a truly great song. Let's not go tripping all over ourselves to call it poetry now, shall we? Rhyming mosquito and libido doesn't really make you Robert Frost. This is my whole thing about how, like, lyrics are a very junior partner to melody in terms of music. And in some cases, they just don't matter at all.
Now, if you deliver this the same way and put the same track behind it, he could be singing about gumdrops and lollipops, and it would not...
No, it doesn't detract at all. I mean, it's like, you know, it really is... It's not what they... It really is just... Rock is very much about how they're saying it. These are the top five unintelligible hit songs of all time. Dawn Taylor.
Number two, The Clash, Rock the Casbah.
Now, again, I'm sure there are big Clash fans in the house who understand all the lyrics. Me, couldn't tell you one. Not a clue.
Boogeyman.
Yeah. You get a little tiny window into our parents listening to whatever we were listening to and just going, I don't know, it's all the same. It's what are these guys, all share one singer? You know, and you kind of get that.
Wait. On a radiator grill.
I think I did know that line. I don't even know what the first half of the chorus is.
Sharia don't like it. Rockin' the Casbah.
Well, that's cheating if they're using proper nouns. Of course I'll never figure that out. Sharia. Whatever.
I prefer open bars.
We banned that boogie sound. I listen to a lot of Clash.
I figured.
Everybody should listen to a lot of Clash.
Crazy cat box sound.
Casbah.
Whatever. All right,
this is the title.
I don't even know what the Casbah is. I really, honestly. All right, these are the top five unintelligible hit songs of all time. Dawn Taylor?
Number one, Pearl Jam, Yellow Ledbetter.
Which, by the way, and I've really gone to the Earth source here. I've contacted Pearl Jam fans high and low over the years, trying to figure out. And it's like no one knows. There's just no all the best that there's this site called 2FeetThick.com, which I think is one of the definitive sort of Pearl Jam fan sites. And the best they've been able to do after like 15 years of the song being performed live all the time, they can get like little pieces.
It's because he was in this period where he was pulling at his shirt all the time while he was singing.
He's compressing his diaphragm. That's the problem.
Has anyone just asked him?
He has been asked about the song. They said, and he joked. He said, he goes, what, do you mean there are lyrics? And then he told like a little roundabout story about the meaning of the song, which the meaning of the song has something to do with a friend who comes back who was killed in the war. But they asked him flat out about the lyrics, and he deflected with a joke and then didn't answer it.
I respect that.
That guy knows where his bread is buttered. Keep him guessing.
On the other hand, if you're going to bother to write lyrics, don't you want people to actually know what your song's about?
Well, you're presuming that he wrote lyrics. You know, Michael Stipe said that a lot of the early R.E.M. records, there are no lyrics at all. He's just muttering. That's where the title Murmur comes from, actually, because he would just, if he didn't know, he would just be like, guitar, you know, or whatever he would say. And then, you know.
At this point, you could only disappoint people by spelling it out, you know, explicitly.
Exactly. I mean, just sounds like just a, I mean, okay. Well, we got to end this now. Don't forget, Don Taylor and I will be on Fun Employment Radio. You can catch that around 6 o'clock Pacific time tonight, funemploymentradio.com. We want to thank our guests, Mr. Ryan White from The Oregonian, Reading and Print in The Oregonian, online at OregonLive.com/music. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Aaron Geek in the City, Duran, also David Walker, and filmmaker Chris Witherspoon. Chris Witherspoon, man behind the new film Rage, which is going to be showing this Thursday at the Witzel Auditorium. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from y'all. So thank you for listening. Please spread the word. Thank you kindly for doing so. It is Monday, January 31st, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. La 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 la.
Oh, baby, baby, have you seen Amy tonight? Is she in the bathroom? Is she smoking up outside? Oh, baby, baby, does she take a piece of lime for the drink that I'ma buy her? Do you know just what she likes? Oh, oh, tell me, have you seen her? Cause I'm so, oh, I can get her off of my brain. I just wanna go to the party, she gon' go, can somebody tell